Everybody, thanks for joining us for a special episode of The Baptist Bias. I'm your host, Pastor Shelley, and I'm actually going to be joined in studio, well, not in studio, but over the internet with one of my friends, Pastor Steven Anderson, and we're going to be talking about Good Friday being debunked. Now, this is definitely a view that's prevalent out there today. Today is what many people will call Good Friday. And I've preached about this in times past, but I wanted to make a special live stream where I showed a lot of the information that I had taught in the past, and then additionally bring on one of my friends, Pastor Steven Anderson, to talk about this. And we want to talk about the timing of the Passover, also talk about the date in which Christ was crucified. We'll be taking some call-ins later in the show. If you are able to call in, even just for a few minutes, we will take your questions. If you have questions, you can put them in the chat. But thanks so much for joining us for this episode. I'm going to welcome on my guest, Pastor Steven Anderson. How's it going, Pastor Anderson?
It's going great. Thanks for having me on.
I really like your shirt. That's a good-looking shirt there. And I'm excited to cover this topic. Now, Good Friday is something that is celebrated pretty much all over the world. Is this something that you grew up believing, or what's your kind of view on Good Friday?
No, absolutely not. This was never a thing amongst fundamental Baptists. I've never heard of any fundamental Baptists celebrating it growing up. And I went to a lot of different churches growing up. Our family moved a few times and everything. But when I was growing up, most Baptists talked about Christ being crucified on Wednesday. And I know that my dad grew up in a church that had been influenced by like Brother Hiles and that crowd. And Brother Hiles had a sermon called The Hoax of Good Friday, and he always taught that it was a Wednesday. So that's what I grew up with.
Well, it was interesting. I read a Wikipedia article about Good Friday, and I was researching this. I wonder if we can pull this up on our screen here in a minute whenever they're ready. But I was looking through this Good Friday article, and it pretty much is very clear it's a Catholic belief. It's a Catholic idea. And I just like did a control F on the Wikipedia article, and I looked for the word Baptist. And let's see if I think we have it ready to pull up on the screen. It even says specifically that some Baptist congregations, the Philadelphia Church of God and some non-denominational churches oppose the observance of Good Friday, regarding it as so-called papist tradition. And then it says, instead observe the crucifixion of Jesus on Wednesday to coincide with the Jewish sacrifice of the Passover lamb. So even this article is saying from a historical perspective that for the most part, Baptists or even a lot of evangelicals didn't necessarily subscribe to a Friday view. They believe that Jesus Christ was crucified on Wednesday. I think growing up, I probably heard about Good Friday and I kind of thought maybe that was true. And then after maybe listening to a lot of different Baptist preaching, I think I ended up switching my view to Wednesday for a while. And what's interesting is I ended up wanting to prove the Wednesday crucifixion. And so I like was researching it because I wanted to disprove Good Friday. And my initial attempt, I kind of couldn't get all the verses to reconcile for Wednesday. And I kind of gave up and just said, well, I guess you can't even know. And it's not necessarily the most important doctrine. It's not necessarily something that's going to alter the course of your church. Obviously, we want to believe in the death, burial, and resurrection, but the exact timing wasn't necessarily that crucial, so I kind of gave up. But eventually, in reading Mark and reading some other passages, I ended up changing my mind that I thought it was possible, and I researched it again, and then I ended up switching to Thursday. Now, I think from your perspective, you also believed in Wednesday for a long time. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, Friday was just never on the table because Matthew 12:40 says, as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And I noticed that even the Wikipedia article cited Matthew 12:40 as evidence for Wednesday. And right. So Friday was never on the table. It was always a question of whether it's Wednesday or Thursday, right? So when I was growing up, I'd always heard Wednesday. I had a guy confront me and try to convince me to Friday. He was a fundamental Baptist. Because even though the churches I grew up in were all Wednesday, you know, obviously there are individuals with different views. He came at me and tried to prove Friday to me. And so I did kind of a deep dive when I was a teenager just to debunk this guy who was like my friend's dad. And, you know, I ended up, you know, being convinced that it was Wednesday. When I started Faith Forward Baptist Church back in 2005, you know, I even preached a few sermons where one of them I borrowed Brother Heil's title and called it The Hoax of Good Friday, but it was a totally different sermon.
Right.
But I used his title. And I, you know, have always preached it as Wednesday because I really wanted the 3 days and three nights to be like three full days and full nights, like 72 hours. And so that was kind of my hang up. But like you, I kind of came to a point where I believed it was Wednesday, but I definitely saw some problems with the Wednesday view. And I kind of at some point just threw up my hands and said, well, some of this is just a little bit confusing, a little bit unknowable, you know, but I still thought it was Wednesday. Then when you came out with the Thursday information, I remember you and I spent probably like total of 8 or 9 hours on the phone, like over the course of several days, kind of arguing back and forth. And I was kind of pushing for the Wednesday view and you were pushing for the Thursday view. And we kind of argued for days. And then finally, you know, you convinced me because the problems that I had with the Wednesday view, the Thursday view solved those problems. And I kind of just had to let go of the 72 hour thing and just realize that it's, you know, it's 3 days and three nights, but it's, you know, the first day is a partial, the final night's a partial, you know, and it works right out perfectly. So I'm totally convinced. I'm totally satisfied with Thursday at this point.
Well, I think if, as long as you pretty much understand that Christ was crucified in the evening or at even, and that he rose again in the morning, then it could never be an exact 72 hours. You're going to have some variation, whether on the short side of 72 or on the long side of 72. But, you know, one thing that I thought was really difficult in this process of trying to understand these things was just the word Passover itself. And I want to bring several verses on the screen and kind of talk about this for a moment. But the word Passover can mean a few different things in Scripture. One of those is it refers to the entire feast that's celebrated. Now, this makes sense just because we use the word Christmas in a similar way. People will talk about Christmas and they'll say it's Christmas time, and they could be talking about the whole month of December. They could be talking about Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. They could be talking about Christmas Day specifically. So Christmas itself is used a lot of times in many different ways to describe different time periods. And I believe Passover also is kind of this catch-all phrase or word that you see in Scripture being described as many different things. Now, here in Luke, it gives us a verse, Luke 22. It says, now the Feast of Unleavened Bread drew nigh, which is called the Passover. So the entire feast itself, all the events of it, are just loosely referred to as the Passover in portions of Scripture. And so some people get confused on the word Passover when they're trying to figure these things out, but we have to understand that Passover could mean a few different things. Additionally, in Exodus chapter number 12, whenever you read through that passage, and I'm not sure which verse we want to go to, but you could bring this up on the screen if you can. In Exodus chapter number 12, when it talks about the days of this feast, it literally says the 14th day in verse number 6, and you just keep it up until the 14th day. So this is when they're supposed to kill the Passover lamb. But then they were supposed to celebrate 7 days of unleavened bread, and it even specifically counts them. And it tells us a little bit further down in this verse, if we just go down a little bit more, it'll tell you it's all the way into the 21st day. And the thing is if you count from 14 to 21, it's actually 8 days, which, you know, if you think about simple math, obviously, if you just add, you take 21 minus 7, that's 14. But what you have to realize is when you're talking about calendar days, if you go from the 14th all the way to the 21st, that's actually a total of 8 days. And so I believe that the Bible is really clear that when it's talking about the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Passover is referring to all of these specific 8 days. Now, let me see if we can find that verse that I want to make sure I'm pointing it out here.
Well, you know, while you're looking for that, I would just say that, you know, this is exactly what's going on in Acts chapter 12, verse 4, where people get hung up on, well, how can the Passover be happening twice? And so they try to make like Easter and Passover be two different things, when in reality, Easter is just the archaic word for Passover. The Greek word that is translated as Easter in the KJV in Acts 12:4 is just the normal word for Passover. But it's translated as Easter because of the fact that all the old Bible translations, like the Tyndale Bible, Matthew Bible, Great Bible, they use the word Easter like 15, 20 times in them. And then when you get to the Bishop's Bible, it only uses the word Easter twice. King James uses it once. But it's referring to the entire week as Easter slash Passover,
right,
in Acts 12:4. And so, but a lot of people are hung up saying like, oh, the modern versions are wrong here. Only the KJV is right when it says Easter because this different day. When really in Acts 12:4, both the modern versions and the KJV are both right because Easter and Passover are literally synonymous at right. that time in 1611. And so.
Yeah. And I was thinking of verse 18. So in verse 18, it says, in the first month, on the 14th day of the month at even, ye shall eat unleavened bread until the 1 and 20th day of the month at even. So that even says specifically on the 14th day, they're supposed to eat unleavened bread too, which is significant when we talk about the Last Supper and specifically the event that the disciples had with Jesus Christ. Now, again, if you count, the 14th is 1, 15th is 2, 16th is 3, 17th is 4, 18th is 5, 19th is 6, 20th is 7, and then you have the 21st, which would be 8 days. So technically the whole feast is an 8-day feast where the first day is the day of preparation, and then you have 7 days of unleavened bread, and that is referred to as the Passover. Now I want to go to the second option we have here for the Passover. We have another screen that I want to show as far as another possible definition of the word Passover. In Luke 22, verse 7, so this is just a little bit further in the same chapter that we talked about what Passover could mean. It has another definition in the same chapter. In Luke 22, verse 7, it says, then came the day of unleavened bread when the Passover must be killed. So the word Passover also refers to the sacrifice itself. The animal that's going to be sacrificed, that lamb that's going to be sacrificed, is referred to as the Passover. And then I want to go to one more in John chapter 18, verse 28, the Bible also gives another idea of the Passover. It says, then led they Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment, and it was early, and they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Now, again, you could say that's kind of the sacrifice, but it's also alluding to the meal in which they would eat, which is on the 15th day. So when we understand the word Passover, it could mean that entire event, that entire 8-calendar section of time. It could refer to the time when they sacrificed the Passover, and it could refer to the time in which they ate or eat that specific Passover. So sometimes when you see the word Passover in the Gospels, it could be any one of those particular times, and that helps us to actually reconcile and try to figure out the exact timing or try to figure out the chronology of these events. So I just wanted to lay that down quickly. Now, when it came to the Wednesday view, John chapter 12 was a verse that I just could not figure out. And this is one where I pretty much just kind of gave up because I knew that Friday wasn't true. And yet I was trying to figure out John chapter 12, verse 1. Because specifically, you know, we have Palm Sunday. And now here's the thing. I believe that Palm Sunday is accurate. But at the time, I was just putting everything on the table, like, let's just try to figure this out. But in John chapter 12, verse 1, the Bible gives us a verse that's giving us a timeline here. And it says in John chapter 12, verse 1, that then Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, which had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. So we know that a specific day is 6 days away from the Passover. Now, again, the Passover could refer to any of those three things prior to. But if you had it on Wednesday, now when you start going backwards 6 days, that's going to cause a problem because of verse 12. In John chapter 12, verse 12, it says, on the next day, much people were come to the feast when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. And then in verse number 13, it says, When they heard that Jesus was coming to the feast or coming to Jerusalem, they took branches of palm trees and went forth to meet him and cried, "Hosanna, blessed is the King of Israel that cometh in the name of the Lord." So we understand that the next day after the 6 days would have been the triumphal entry of Jesus Christ, which we celebrate today as Palm Sunday. And this would be a problem if we backed it up a day, because then that would fall on a Sabbath day. And then it would be kind of strange that you have people like cutting off palm branches and doing all this work and kind of making a big deal about this triumphant entry when it would fall on a particular, potentially a Sabbath day. Now, I have a chart, and I want to kind of pull this up too, that I've made, and I will reference this throughout the live stream.
Yeah, and while you pull that up, I'll just point out the fact that, you know, one of the reasons that we like Palm Sunday, and we're going to see this on the chart, is that it corresponds with the 10th day of the month, which if we go back to the Old Testament, that's when the lamb would be selected, right? The lamb would be presented without spot, without blemish, and it would be, you know, then observed for the next few days before they actually kill it for the Passover. So that 10th day of the month and Palm Sunday work out perfectly, you know, the lamb's being presented, and that's what Palm Sunday is, when right. Jesus Christ does the triumphal entry. And so
exactly
that John 12 passage is a problem for the Wednesday view.
So see if we can pull this up. I have a chart that I had made a while back, and you know, there's a lot of things going on the screen here, but if you look at the ninth day of Nisan, which is Saturday, which would have been their Sabbath, I have that verse there in John 12 verse 1, which is 6 days before the Passover. Now, if you count and you kind of just get to figure out what the days are, Sunday, that day there, that little sun, that would be one. Monday would be two. Tuesday would be three. Wednesday would be four. Thursday would be five. And then here's the thing. Friday would be six. But here's the thing. That is the day when they ate the Passover. So I believe when it's talking about here in John chapter 12, verse 1, that it's 6 days before the Passover, it's not saying the first day of the feast. It's talking about when they would eat the Passover specifically, and that reconciles. Whereas if I tried to go with Wednesday, now I'm really having to back it up, because you could interpret this verse. You could interpret 6 days before the Passover as being the first day of the event. And that's to kind of support the Friday view. But we'll see how the Friday view doesn't make sense from other verses. But here's the thing. If we talk about the Wednesday view, it gets really difficult on a Wednesday view to have 6 days in any context before they potentially eat the Passover, which would be the farthest timeline we have. But this still makes perfect sense. And then, of course, you have the triumphal entry mentioned in all the Gospels there on the 10th day, which, like you said, reconciles with Exodus chapter 12, verse 3, which tells them that they have to, on the 10th day, choose a lamb or select a lamb. And it's like the children of Israel are selecting Jesus Christ as he's coming in that triumphant entry in Jerusalem. And he's fulfilling that particular portion of scripture, that prophetic picture of him. Now, I want to also go to another verse here that's on this chart. It's after 2 days was the feast of the Passover. And I want to look at Mark chapter 14. This is also another pivotal section of scripture when we talk about understanding the timeline of these events. Now, Mark chapter 14, verse 1 says this: after 2 days was the feast of the Passover and of unleavened bread, and the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might take him by craft and put him to death. Now, again, it's being pretty clear here. The feast, again, is when they would eat. So if we go back to my chart that I had there, you can see that there's after 2 days was the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Well, that would have been on Tuesday, which we would have had Wednesday and Thursday, which would be 1 day, 2 days. And then again, on Friday is when you would eat that particular feast. Now, the reason why that's important is because Mark is really clear on its timeline. Now, I want to go to the spreadsheet that I have, because you would say, well, why you just randomly put that on Tuesday? Well, I didn't just randomly put that on Tuesday, because if you look at this kind of spreadsheet, Ivan, and we'll probably try to share these. I'll share these links with you later. I'll put them in the description after the stream, and you can kind of walk it through. But you have Mark 11, verse 1 here coinciding with the triumphant entry. And then you have a verse in Mark 11, 12. If you scroll down a little bit, it's highlighted in blue. And in Mark 11, verse 12, it says, "And on the morrow, when they were come from Bethany, he was hungry." So you have like Sunday being established in verse 1 in chapter 11. Then you have another day. Well, that would be Monday. Then you have Mark 11, 20, which says, "And in the morning, as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots." Well, now we pass into another day, which would be Tuesday. And then, of course, in Mark chapter, if you kind of read through chapters 11 all the way to chapter 14, we haven't switched days from reading the book of Mark. And then it says in Mark 14, verse 1, after 2 days was the feast of the Passover. So the earliest that particular verse could be is Tuesday. Because we have Sunday, then we have a morning, then we have another day. So the earliest that could be is Tuesday. You can't back it up anymore. Well, that's going to present a problem for a Wednesday view. Because again, how do you get 2 days till that particular point if he was crucified on Wednesday? You really can't very easily. And so, you know, this, because that's when they're supposed to eat that feast. So that's another verse that kind of was confusing to me. When I had the Wednesday view, I'm thinking like, I can't really seem to make this John verse fit, and I can't seem to really make this Mark verse fit as well. There's another one that I want to go to that was on the chart that's in Luke. And this one was specific. See if you can pull up the chart, not the Excel spreadsheet. The chart that I have, yeah, this diagram. If you look at the end of the chart on the right, there on Sunday, it says, "Today is the third day since," and Luke 24. Now, I have that verse. Let's see if we can pull up that verse on the screen as well. But this is a verse that I think also is just like super clear on our particular timeline. Now, in Luke chapter 24, this is the walk to Emmaus. This is when two men are walking and they are encountered with Jesus Christ. And they are kind of explaining to Jesus what's going on, because he's kind of asking them about like why they're so sad, or, you know, why they're kind of glum. And it says here, this is the two men talking to Jesus. This is one of the guys talking to him. He says, "And how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him," talking about Jesus, "to be condemned to death and have crucified him. But we trusted that it had been he which should have redeemed Israel. And beside all this, today is the third day since these things were done." So these two verses tell us that, number one, it's bringing up the event of him being crucified. And it's saying today is the third day since. Well, we know that that was still the first day of the week from the context of the passage. So we're in the first day of the week. If that's the third day since, then we'd have to understand that Sunday is the third day since. And then that would make Saturday the second day since. And then that would make Friday the first day since. What? Since he was crucified, which would then perfectly, again, align with a crucifixion on Thursday. So I think that verse is actually really important. And that word "since" there is a pretty crucial word, because it really clarifies. Because sometimes you could kind of shift days. You could say 2 days. Are we counting today? Or are we not counting today? Are we counting the next day? Like, sometimes it can be, you know, ambiguous how you would calculate days. And so there is a little bit of possibility you can shift some of these things. But Luke 24 starts to kind of bring it into view of being a very clear, specific timeline, where now it's the third day since what? Since he was crucified. Well, that would put it on Thursday. And then when you plot Thursday with these other verses, they kind of all fit together in a cohesive narrative, and it kind of makes perfect sense. Now, to address, I think one of the verses that we brought up earlier, Matthew 12, verse 40, "For as Jonas was 3 days and three nights in the whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." I want to go back to my chart and show how that's true with a Thursday view. If you look,
yeah, and while you're going there, let me just remind the viewer at home why Friday is so ridiculous in light of 3 days and three nights. To hold the Friday view, you kind of just have to ignore or discard Matthew 12:40, which Baptists just aren't willing to do. You know, we believe every verse of the Bible. We're not willing to just ignore any piece of evidence. And this is why it's very rare for Baptists to believe in a Friday view, because it's just so impossible. Because if Christ died on Friday, you have Friday night and Saturday night, but there is no way to get that third night. It certainly can't be Sunday night. It can't be Thursday night. So what is it? I mean, it's just, there is no third night, no matter how you cook the books. It's just not going to work. And so this is why I've never even entertained a Friday view.
It's really just 2 days and two nights. If Friday was true, yeah. Because you have the Friday day partial, you have the Friday night, yeah. Then you have Saturday day, then you have Saturday night, but then he rose before the day, before the dawn on Sunday. So you really just have 2 days and two nights.
You really just have 2 days and two nights. You're absolutely right. But what I'm saying is someone could try to finagle and wiggle and try to somehow count Sunday morning, even though I agree with you, there's no way to count Sunday morning. But even if you wanted to try to finagle that, you can't even come close to the third night. It's just right. Not there. And so that's why that view should be rejected out of hand. And it doesn't matter whether it's believed in by pagan idolaters called Roman Catholics all over the world. Yeah, they have the huge numbers and they have the loudest voice because they have their big institution, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, and they have all their scholars and people promoting this stuff. But it just isn't happening, you know?
Right.
And so Matthew 12:40 is just a complete deal breaker for Friday. It does leave room for Wednesday or Thursday. Sure. And that's what you're about to show.
Yeah. And again, you know, I want to show, bring up that chart if you can, again, because I want to show this on the screen. But it's very clear that Jesus Christ died at the ninth hour. That's what the text says. And if we kind of understand what the ninth hour means, that means 3 p.m. because they're counting it from essentially sun dawning or coming up. And that would be approximately 6 a.m. Obviously, it's going to vary a little bit, but we're just using even, easy numbers. If you assume that the sun rose at 6 a.m., we're talking about 3 p.m. for that particular day. That's when Jesus Christ died. Well, that's going to put him in the grave, or being dead technically, for 3 hours of Thursday. So you would have Thursday as one day. You would have that as a day. Then you would have Thursday night. So you have Thursday day, you have Thursday night, then you have Friday day, then you have Friday night, then you have Saturday day, and you have Saturday night. And he rose before the sun came up on Sunday. So you literally have 3 days and three nights. Now, this is exactly how we speak and communicate today, because if I were traveling anywhere and I get on a plane right now, if I got on a plane right now and I flew to Arizona to see Pastor Anderson, and I arrive sometime in the afternoon, let's say 4 o'clock, and I stay the night, and then I get up in the morning, fly back home at noon, and someone says, well, how long were you in Phoenix? I would say, well, 2 days and one night, because I was there for that first part of the day, then the evening, and the next day. I wouldn't be trying to say that it had to be exactly 48 hours and, you know, or something like that. I'm just trying to communicate that I was there on today, Friday night, and Saturday day. That's what I was communicating. And hotels, this is exactly how they communicate. They want to know how many days and nights you are, the time you arrive, the time that you leave. And of course, if you spent 3 hours in hell, you know, you're going to count that as part of being in hell for that day.
Well, Let me explain it another way that I think might help people at home too. If I said I work 5 days a week, you know, it's like work is taking place on Monday. It's taking place on Tuesday. It's taking place on Wednesday. Not necessarily the whole day. It doesn't necessarily say what time I'm working those shifts. I could work a 3 hour shift, an 8 hour shift, a 12 hour shift. But the point is, 3 days is 3 calendar days. And again, this goes into the understanding of the day of the Lord. I don't think of the day of the Lord as a 24-hour period as much as I would think of the day of the Lord as a day on the calendar.
Right.
It's a certain day that these things happen on that particular day. And so 3 days and three nights, it's just this simple. Thursday, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday, Saturday night. That's 3 days and three nights. It doesn't have to be the whole day.
Exactly.
Because that, like you said, that's not really how we talk.
Well, and anybody that just understands that Christ was died at the ninth hour would realize that it's never going to reconcile to a perfect 12-hour day for that specific day, because that day was a partial day.
Just to play the devil's advocate, let me give you the what the Wednesday response would be, because sure. I believed this for years. I defended the Wednesday position for many years, and so I understand the thinking behind Wednesday. And if anybody at home, you know, believes Wednesday, you know, that's okay, because at least you're not denying Matthew 12:40.
Right.
When I believed Wednesday, the way that I reconciled it was I would just say, well, Jesus didn't actually die right at 3 p.m. You know, that's the last timestamp we have. But my thought was that he actually died at like 6 p.m. Okay. And then that starts the 72 hours. And then you have basically Christ rising from the grave during the night of Saturday night. So basically he comes to life, you know, at 6 p.m. on Saturday night, which is technically the first day of the week, because, you know, the evening and the morning were the first day. So then that's your 72 hours. And then you have Christ rising from the dead, like in the night, coming out of the tomb. And look, I don't agree with it. I don't believe in it. That's what I used to believe. That's how you'd make it work. That's how you get the 72 hours exactly of death, is just dying on the cross at 6
p.m.,
you know, being buried. And look, of course, there are problems with it, but I'm just saying that's where the Wednesday crowd is coming from.
Yeah, and I can understand if that was true, if he died at 6 p.m. and then he rose at 6 a.m., you could have your 72 hours potentially. The problem with that view is that we understand that they had to bury Jesus Christ's body, and they were trying to do it hastily so that they would do it before the even had switched, because they were going to go into the 15th day, which was a Sabbath day, and they couldn't do that work. And additionally, we understand that the women going to see Jesus Christ were already coming before the sun had even came to dawn, and he had already risen. So it doesn't really gel with the context and a lot of the other things that are happening during those periods of time. It also seems pretty clear to me when you read the passage about the ninth hour, that that's the moment that he died. So if, you know, again, if you understand that as to when he died, then you couldn't have that perfect 6 p.m.
Well, that is when he died, because like you said, they need time to stab him with a spear, make sure he's dead, water and blood come out. They need time to take him down from the cross. They need time to take his body to the tomb, get it in the tomb. And that all technically should be happening before 6 p.m. And so that's why the 3 p.m. time of death works. Okay. But, you know, I'm just saying, for the Wednesday view, the reason that I liked the idea of him dying at 6 p.m. is because then, like, the Passover is being killed at even. You know, so I kind of liked that aspect of it. And then if he comes back to life at 6 p.m., as, you know, on Saturday night, becoming, you know, the first day of the week, then he rises from the grave during the night, and then they get there early and he's already gone and whatever. But again, you know, there are problems with it, because number one, you need all the time for that stuff to happen between 3 p.m. and 6 p.m., as you mentioned. And also, something just seems off about Christ, like, rising from the dead way before Sunday morning. Like, you know what I mean? Like rising that early in the night, something doesn't feel right about that either. So those are some of the things that I never really liked about the Wednesday view, some of the difficulties.
Right. Well, and again, if you kind of think about the sacrifice itself, because, you know, obviously Christ is the ultimate Passover, but they've been performing Passovers for centuries here, and they need time to slaughter the animal, drain the blood, roast it with fire, and get it all set up so that they can eat it, because they have to have all that work done before the Sabbath, before the sun goes down. So that's like a really important aspect of the fact, because the Bible's like super clear. I believe in Leviticus 23, I want to say it's either Leviticus 23 or Exodus 12, that there's no work to be done whatsoever on that 15th day except for eating. Like, that's the only thing they're allowed to do is to eat. So they have to do it in haste. They have to do it quickly. And again, even the first Passover is supposed to be done in haste because they have to spread the blood of the lamb on the doorposts. And it's kind of a something that they need to do very quickly. There's a sense of urgency about it. And so you see that sense of urgency carrying forward into the New Testament with Jesus Christ, how they need to get this body in the tomb and then buried before the Sabbath. And I think, you know, God probably has a lot of reasons why this is true. One reason is probably also true is they wanted to get his body wound up and bound very quickly so that it saw no corruption. Because the Bible says very clearly that Jesus Christ's body saw no corruption. Well, here's the thing. If Jesus Christ's body is dead and it's hanging on this cross for the whole Sabbath time period, like the Jews are not allowed to touch his body for that whole time, the chances of it seeing corruption are really high, just from animals and buzzards and just like all kinds of other things. So it's like really, really important that his body gets bound up and put in the tomb so that it can see no corruption, apart from obviously the stabbing and the nails from the cross and everything that he experienced there. And so there's a lot of events there that need to take place. I believe I don't have this. Well, see if we can go to the Bible. I want to see, pull up a verse when it's Joseph of Arimathea craving the body of Jesus, because it actually makes it kind of clear from a timeline perspective here, what we're talking about.
Well, and another thing is they don't want to leave him hanging on the cross throughout the Sabbath because of the fact that, you remember the verse in Deuteronomy about if they, you know, cursed is he that hangeth from a tree. And so when they hang someone from a tree, they're supposed to remove the body before sundown as well. And so they have to do that before the Sabbath because that's, you know, they're not supposed to be doing that kind of work on the Sabbath, right?
Yeah. There's a verse I want to go to in Mark chapter 15. It's verses 42 and 43. We're just going to pull up like Bible Gateway or something. See if you can pull that up on the screen. Mark chapter 15, verses 42 and 43, because when we're talking about the death of Jesus Christ, the Bible gives a couple pretty clear verses. I'm just going to start reading. Maybe we can pull it up here in a second. Mark chapter 15, verse 42. And now when the even was come, because it was the preparation, that is the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, an honorable counselor, which also waited for the kingdom of God, came and went in boldly unto Pilate and craved the body of Jesus. So it's saying in verse 42 that it was the day of preparation. It's the day before the Sabbath. So they haven't switched days yet, meaning that we haven't actually crossed over that 6 p.m. threshold. And it says in verse 45, and when he knew it of the centurion, he gave the body. I'm sorry, verse 44. And Pilate marveled if he were already dead. And calling unto him the centurion, he asked him whether he had been any while dead, and when he knew it of the centurion, he gave the body to Joseph. So in Mark chapter 15, it's clear that, well, like at least a some period of time before the day had switched, before we'd crossed over, that Joseph of Arimathea was already asking for the dead body of Jesus Christ, and it's been certified by the centurions, and Pilate acknowledges it and gives him the body. So, and he was kind of surprised at how quickly it had happened. So in the other, I believe the other two thieves actually had to have their legs break to die because they hadn't died yet. And so, or they were pierced with the spear to, you know, I don't know exactly.
So they had their, they had their legs broken, which was the standard practice.
Right.
But when the Roman soldier sees that Jesus is already dead,
he stabs him,
break his legs. And yeah. And so he does something that's like unusual or out of the ordinary by stabbing him. And of course, this fulfills the scripture. They shall look on, you know, me whom they have pierced, and the blood and water running out has significance and so forth.
Yes. And so, and that there was no bone of him broken, which you would think
there was no bone would be broken.
That would be kind of contradictory because he was crucified. You would think like, oh, they're going to break his bones, but then they ended up not. Yeah. So there's a lot of prophecy there. But again, that makes sense. If you look at my chart, see if you can probably pull that up again pretty quickly. Down in the bottom right, I actually have kind of a blown up version of Thursday. So you can kind of see like a little general timeline of what had happened. But at 6 a.m., they said, behold your king. Now that's kind of significant because they're supposed to like present the lamb and they're like presenting the lamb on that specific day. So this is like that picture of them presenting the lamb. Then they crucified him at 9 a.m., which I have the verse there. Then at noon, there was darkness over the whole land. And then essentially at 3, which the Bible says is the ninth hour, that's when Jesus Christ gave up the ghost. Now, again, I put on the chart 3 to 4 p.m. because I don't know if it necessarily happened at 3:00 p.m. or if it happened at 3:15 or 3:30 or whatever, just in the ninth hour. And then that basically gives them 2+ hours to take him off the for him to be stabbed, taken off the cross, for him to be wound up, and then taken to the sepulcher. And they make it really clear that the sepulcher was very close, so they had an opportunity. Like, they didn't have to travel a very great distance to take his body there.
So while you have this chart pulled up too, if you could put the chart back on the screen, I want to say that, you know, back when I held to the Wednesday view, because I had done my own deep dive on this. Obviously, it was the teaching that I'd grown up with, but I'd also gone to the scripture and done the deep dive myself, and I still came up with Wednesday. And I'll tell you the reason that I was wrong, the mistake that I made was I still had essentially a lot of the same things on the timeline as you have here, as far as like the 10th day being Palm Sunday and the 17th day being, you know, the following Sunday when Christ rose and everything like that. The mistake that I was making, though, is that I thought of the 13th day as the preparation day, and that they're basically eating the Passover on Wednesday evening as it's becoming the 14th.
Right.
So that was one of the obstacles that I had to overcome in order to understand that it's actually Thursday, is that I had the 13th labeled as the preparation day. And then that creates problems with some of the verses, which is why there were always some things that didn't quite sit well with me about the Wednesday view. And so that's why, and I used to say back then, like, that I believed it was Wednesday, but I used to say it might be Thursday. I used to say, you know, I think it's like 90% that it's Wednesday, 10% that it's Thursday. Now I'm 100% that it's Thursday, you know?
Yeah. I mean,
or at least 99.9, you know?
I thought it was for sure Wednesday. I thought the Bible was really clear on it. And then I kind of proved myself wrong, which for me, after giving up, it was Mark that changed my mind. Because again, Mark actually gives you so many different markers of time that I started realizing, like, hey, Mark's actually kind of fitting this all together, because you have Palm Sunday, then you have the day when he curses the fig tree, then the next day he comes and he sees the fig tree that he cursed. Then it says, hey, after 2 days of the Feast of the Passover. And I was like, well, wow, that just puts it right on Thursday. And then that actually jives with every other verse. And so by just kind of plotting them all together, it kind of, to me, fit really obviously. You know, and again, the 14th day being the preparation day is really important, because you have to kind of understand the context of what they're doing. They have to do a lot of work to enjoy the 7 days. And so they have to get all these things prepared. Now, even the preparation day itself does technically have a little bit of prep. So there is a verse that I want to bring up here on this chart. It's the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. There's 4 different references to it. Go, if you would, to the Excel spreadsheet. This is what I want you to go to, is the Excel spreadsheet, because this is a verse that I kind of struggled with at first to kind of understand here. Scroll, if you would, to the purple. Bring that up more in the middle of the screen if you can. But in the purple section, this is, again, that Tuesday, or I'm sorry, the Wednesday timeline. So this is Wednesday that we're looking at, and I kind of made this chart where it shows that it's Wednesday. But this is in Mark 14, verse 12, this is what it says. And on the first day of unleavened bread, when they killed the Passover, his disciples said unto him, where wilt thou that we go and prepare that thou mayest eat the Passover? So like a verse like this to me kind of would lead me to believe what you said, Pastor Anderson, that it's like, oh, they're like eating the Passover maybe on that Wednesday at the Last Supper. It's kind of a little bit confusing. But how you can understand this, I want to flip back to the chart in this. But if you go back to the chart, what it's actually saying here is that on Wednesday, and I'm just going to throw out a time, this is arbitrary, but let's just say it's like 3 p.m. It's 3 p.m. on Wednesday. His disciples look at them and they say, hey, this is the first day of unleavened bread. What does that mean? Well, if you notice at the top of my chart, you kind of have these little curly braces at the top of the 14th day. The 14th day actually does happen on Wednesday. It happens at 6 p.m. on Wednesday. So it would be accurate for them, in a sense, from a Roman calendar day, to say today, or this is the day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, that's going to happen that specific day, because their Jewish calendar falls on Wednesday. It falls on that evening. Now, then it has this qualifier, when they killed the Passover. Well, when they killed the Passover is specifically the 14th day. They're not going to kill it at 6 p.m., but it is going to happen on the 14th day. So this is a kind of an analogy I thought of. If we had a Jewish calendar, which we don't, and that's how we celebrated Christmas, if it was Christmas Eve, if it was the 24th of December, and it's 3 p.m., and let's just say, again, our Jewish calendar is going to make Christmas Day start at 6 p.m. that day. And I just said, hey, today's the day when it's going to be Christmas, when people open presents. Well, again, we may not even open the presents at 6 p.m. We may wait until the morning on the 25th to open the presents. But it's accurate to say on the 24th that that was Christmas Day, because it's going to overlap on that time period. So again, it's sometimes a little confusing, just because a Jewish calendar day starts at 6 p.m., whereas Roman days start at midnight. And this is a pretty well-established fact. I mean, you can even look it up. Roman calendar and when they calculated noon, they basically calculated noon as a major event. And so they counted 12 hours. They get to 12 a.m., and that's basically how they started calculating days. This was centuries before Jesus Christ was even born that the Romans had this idea. Some literature even suggests that the Greeks also observed a similar practice. I'm not an expert historian on this, but again, this is for sure a practice that Rome was observing at the time of Christ and well before Christ, and it's existed all the way till today. And think about it this way. Much of our calendar has remained the same, considering the fact that it's 2024, which is 2024 years from Christ. You know, and again, it's not exact, but that's around the time that we believe that he was born.
We're going to talk about a little bit later in the broadcast exactly what year Christ was born and exactly what year Christ died. But I want to say this verse that you're talking about in Matthew right now, I remember back when you and I were going back and forth about this, this verse was the one that actually made me come over to the Thursday view. Like, I remember the moment in my mind when I'm like, you know what? You're right, Pastor Shelley. Like, it's Thursday. It was literally this verse, because of the fact that there's always been this kind of contradiction that I couldn't quite reconcile about, like, and people bring this up a lot, even just other, you know, biblical scholars out there in the world, you know, is he crucified the day before the Passover? Is he crucified on the Passover? You know, and it's like, this verse right here actually works with the Thursday view in light of everything else. Whereas with the Wednesday view, there are some irreconcilable differences here. And so, you know, once I understood what you just explained about this verse, to me, that just kind of solved the last problem that I had as far as trying to, like, reconcile the Passion Week. And that's when I was like, okay, I'm sold. And the thing that is good about the Thursday view is that it really deals with every verse. Your chart deals with every verse. And it, in my mind, it solves all the problems. And so everything works. Everything fits. Whereas with the Wednesday view, you have a few uncomfortable things. With the Friday view, you have this elephant in the room of it can't be 3 days and three nights.
Right.
You know, I feel like the Thursday view is the comprehensive view.
Well, and again, you know, a point that I was trying to get at is this. In Exodus, it made it clear that they're not even allowed to eat leavened bread on the 14th day. So if you think about it, that's why the disciples had to go and set up for the Lord's Supper or prepare for the Lord's Supper before it even happened, because they had to make sure that they had no leaven for the Last Supper, even though that wasn't the event that they were going to eat the Passover. The preparation day is a specific day too. So it's kind of like it goes in stages. Stage one, prepare and make sure you're not going to have any unleavened bread. And then on the 14th day, they're really busy with the lamb, because they have to they have to present the lamb, and then they have to get it ready, and then they have to they have to kill it and slaughter it and cook it. So like they're really dealing a lot with the lamb, so they don't have time to be dealing with all the bread. So
at the Last Supper, they're eating unleavened bread because it's already the 14th.
Right.
That's why they're saying a few hours later, oh, hey, the day has arrived. From a Roman perspective, the day has arrived. And then they get there that night. They're eating unleavened bread. They're not eating a lamb at the Last Supper.
Right. Well, they would have been busy. They would have been busy getting that ready, too. Like, think about it. If that verse was when they were going to eat the lamb, then that, you know, this time when they're talking, he would have been like, let's get a lamb, let's slaughter it, let's start cooking, let's roast it with fire because we're going to have to eat this thing. And that's
not even. And then everybody else would have been like, what are you guys doing? Because this is a day early. Like, what are you even doing? It wouldn't even make sense, right?
Right. Well, everybody would be doing the same thing. So everybody.
No, they wouldn't be doing the same. No, I'm saying if Jesus was eating a lamb at the Last Supper, he'd be doing it 24 hours before everybody else.
Right.
Am I right?
Well, I'm just saying that
because they're eating the Passover on Thursday night. That's why, remember, they don't want to come in the judgment hall.
I know. I'm saying all those verses contradict that view. I was going to bring that up. It's just it's super clear that no one else has eaten the Sabbath yet because they're making it clear they don't want to defile themselves so they can eat the Sabbath and they can eat the Passover. And just like there's all this conversation about that in the text. So that there's no way they just had the Passover unless, like you said, him and his disciples are just having it a completely different day as everybody else or something.
That's what I'm saying.
Which would be weird.
But this has actually been like a controversy in Christianity for a long time of like, why is Jesus doing the Passover a day early and whatever? And there are even people out there that say, oh, he's doing the Essene calendar, the Essene Passover. And, you know, the Jews are doing a different calendar, which is obviously bogus. But this is something that people bring up a lot as something difficult to reconcile. But that's, I feel like once you understand the Thursday view, and understand that the Roman calendar is intersecting with the Jewish calendar, then it fixes everything. It fixes the contradiction. And that's what I like about it.
Right.
That's why I feel like Thursday view is so rewarding because it fixes that age-old question, you know, that a lot of people have been confused by. You know, are Jesus and his disciples doing the Passover early or, you know, what's going on? But it makes sense if you understand that, well, they're not eating the lamb, they're just starting to do the unleavened bread because it's the 14th.
Right, exactly.
So they're starting to observe that. That makes sense.
Because it's an 8-day feast, even though it's 7 days of unleavened bread, you constantly hear that, but that's just a portion of the feast. The 14th day is also part of this special event, a special holiday that you would celebrate, and it's technically an 8-day feast that includes the whole preparation day is a big portion of this particular feast. And so I think that there's a lot of verses here that you kind of have to get in your mind to understand, to kind of reconcile. But once you kind of slowly put the pieces together, and I think a chart helps. I'm a visual learner. So for me, unless I had that chronology like kind of written out or have a chart, like it's really difficult for me to ever comprehend what we're talking about. Go back to this chart. I want to show one more thing here that's kind of interesting. With the Thursday view, is since he died on Thursday, well, according to Exodus, you would have a special holy convocation on the next day. That's what the Bible says, or the first day of the 7 days of unleavened bread, which would be the 15th day. And so I have kind of highlighted up there in the chart, the 15th is in red, feast day. This is a Sabbath day. And it's a high day. It's mentioned in the scripture as being a high day, meaning it's not just a normal Sabbath. This is like a special Sabbath day that is to be observed. Then, of course, if he died on Thursday, you run into another Sabbath. That's just how it works on the 16th. So basically, you have the vast majority of the time, or virtually the whole time while Christ is in hell, you have a Sabbath of man resting. Which kind of pictures an interesting point of while Christ is doing the work for us, we're resting, similar to how in the gospel, we simply rest in his finished work and the work that he did for our salvation and for the gospel. And then he rises again on the first day of the week, which is the 17th. Now, what's interesting about this is in Leviticus, I believe it's in Leviticus. I would have to double check the reference, but it brings up the idea of doing a wave offering or the first fruits offering, and it's going to be happening right after this specific 15th day. Well, you wouldn't have it on the 16th in our view because you run into another Sabbath, so you'd have to wait a whole other day, which means that their first fruit offering would have been on the 17th day, which would have been Sunday, which corresponds exactly to the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which is our first fruits. The Bible tells us that Jesus Christ is our first fruit. And then they have to wait, you know, to reap the rest of their harvest. So there's a time gap, which is exactly what we have in biblical prophecy, where Jesus Christ is the first risen from the dead. There's going to be a time gap. And then there's going to be the rapture or the great harvest where the Christians are going to be harvested. And so all of these feast days actually picture and foreshadow future events and Jesus Christ and the rapture and the harvest. And it's really kind of incredible. I don't understand how, you know, people that can see these truths in the Bible couldn't just understand that the Bible is the word of God. I mean, there's no way man is writing this. This is just an incredible masterpiece that is beyond human comprehension. All the intricacies. And not only that, not only did this narrative get written like this, this Bible has stood the test of time. Like, he's writing about these things that are going to happen thousands of years in the future, and then they happen exactly like they did thousands of years in the future. I mean, that is extreme. That's impossible. There's no way you could do something like that. I mean, the Bible is just so evident that it's true, and these prophecies of Jesus Christ are super incredible. I want to get, if we have any callers, I know I want to be sensitive to people on their lunch break or whatever. If you want to call in, you can call in 231 Baptist, ask a question. If we can't go to you right away, you can just leave your question and we'll try to answer it on the show. 231 Baptist, or you can put one in the chat. Some people are
so real quick,
saying, oh, it's Friday. You're twisting scripture.
Yeah. But, so real quick. So let me kind of play the devil's advocate again.
Yeah.
And kind of give the evidence for Friday.
Sure. Okay.
Which, like I said, I've never even entertained Friday because it just violates Matthew 12:40. Period. End of story. But what the Friday crowd has going for them is the verses saying that Jesus is crucified on the preparation of the Sabbath. That's what they have going for them. All these verses saying that Christ is crucified the day before the Sabbath, the preparation for the Sabbath, a lot of verses like that. And then they're just thinking that's Friday. Day before the Sabbath must be Friday. But the problem is that they're not recognizing that in John it says that Sabbath was a high day. And they're also not recognizing the fact that holidays in the Old Testament are called Sabbaths. You know, you can go to Old Testament scripture and show where he will call things like the Day of Atonement or just holidays that don't necessarily fall on Saturday. He calls those a Sabbath of rest unto you, because the word Shabbat just simply means rest or ceasing from work. And so what they're not understanding is that when it says it's the preparation for the Sabbath, it's not talking about the Saturday Sabbath. It's talking about the Sabbath that's the holiday, the 15th day of the month. And really, that's the only compelling argument that the Friday crowd has, is just all the verses about it being the preparation for the Sabbath. Or, you know, Christ crucified, they rest during the Sabbath, and then Christ raises. But what they're not understanding is that there are two Sabbaths back to back. The 15th is a Sabbath of rest unto right. The Israelites, because it's a holiday.
Yeah, let's.
And
let's,
then they have the Saturday. It's a 3-day weekend, folks.
Bring up, you know, the verse that he was talking about. So in John 19, verse 31, we actually have kind of a verse that you're alluding to. It says, the Jews, therefore, because it was the preparation that the body should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath day was an high day, besought Pilate that their legs might be broken, that they might be taken away. So again, you're right that it's saying the Sabbath day there, but it tells us, like, real explicitly, this isn't just like a normal Sabbath day. This is an high day. What would be the justification for that clarification if it was just a normal Sabbath?
Like, yeah, if it were just, let's say it were Saturday, it wouldn't be like, well, here, let me explain to you why they can't do any work on this day. Like, there'd be no explanation needed. Saturday is the Sabbath. We get it. Done. But the fact that it's a high day is that it's not the normal Saturday Sabbath. It's a holiday Sabbath. Because again, the word Shabbat is simply referring to rest or ceasing from work. And you can find places where it will say that this is a Sabbath of rest unto you. It's Sabbath days are not just on Saturdays. It's any day that's any day where they're not supposed to work is a Sabbath of rest unto them.
Right. So again, you know, there are some verses that kind of get brought up as suggesting other views. And there's an article from Got Questions. And I want to go to that just because I want to try and present the other side a little bit. And they have a article called On What Day Was Jesus Crucified? And then they kind of lay out a Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday view. Now, in the specific article, if you scroll down a little bit, it's going to kind of talk about those different views. And we've probably addressed some of these things already, but I just kind of want to look at a few things. If he was crucified on a Friday, this is like kind of what you were bringing up, then you have those things the day before the Sabbath. So like Mark 15:42 is a verse that they're pointing to, says that Jesus was crucified on the day before the Sabbath. And again, here they would just say that that's Saturday. But then there, towards the bottom, you'll notice right there, it says, according to the Friday view, the quote, 3 days and three nights prophecy of Matthew 12:40 was fulfilled in that both Jesus and Jonah were, quote, confined in difficult situations where they could not move about freely for three periods of darkness, night, and three periods of light day. The three nights of confinement for Jesus were his arrest on Thursday night and his tomb and his time in the tomb Friday night and or Saturday. 3 days for Jesus were all day Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
I mean, that's just stupid. It doesn't say confined. It says that the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. When he's arrested and before Herod and before Pilate, he's not in the heart of the earth. I'm sorry, but that's ridiculous.
Honestly, that was a really bad explanation. I've seen a Catholic website and they say, well, 3 days and three nights is just a phrase that just means 3 days. So we can't take it overly literal. But again, that's pretty much how Catholics are always with the Bible, that when there's something that just clearly contradicts what they believe, it's just like graven images or something. It's like, oh, we don't want to take that overly literal or something.
You know, it's kind of ironic when somebody who believes they're literally eating the body and blood of Jesus tells us not to take things too literally.
Right.
Talk about the pot calling the kettle black. They take everything too literally.
Well, it's funny because when we take things metaphorically or spiritually, they take them literally. And then when we take them literally, now all of a sudden it's metaphorically.
That's because they're wrong about literally everything because they're a bunch of pagan idolaters.
Right. I mean, if Catholics believe anything, it should almost just be suspect. I think that the only thing I can really think of that I agree with is Palm Sunday. Like, I do agree with Palm Sunday. That's definitely matches and jives with scripture and the chart. But I think they're wrong.
Even things they're right about, they find a way to screw it up.
Well, they got like Ash Wednesday and Lent going on.
So like the virgin birth. You know, it's like, well, they're right on the virgin birth. But then they make the virgin birth weird.
Eternal.
And they make it weird where she's eternally a virgin and how like Jesus didn't even like come out of her birth canal. He had to like be beamed out like Star Trek or something. Like they find a way to ruin even the doctrines that they're somewhat right about. And so they have no authority. I mean, if anything, like you said, the fact that they believe in it, it doesn't make it more likely. It makes it less likely because they screw up everything that they touch.
Virtually. So, I want to go back to that Got Questions article. And what's interesting, and I don't want to go to it just yet, but I just want to note that they talk about the actual year in which Jesus was crucified. And they say if you take a Friday view, Jesus was crucified in AD 30. Now, if we scroll down to the Thursday view here in this Got Questions article, it basically points to a lot of things that we brought up, the 3 days and three nights and how that reconciles a lot smoother. It actually makes sense. And essentially, they talk about the Sabbath. They explain how that works and how there was two Sabbaths. And so just kind of exactly what we said. Then it's interesting. They even bring up the road to Emmaus point that I brought up, how is the third day since, which I think is just like a nail in the coffin. One thing that this article does say, though, is on a Thursday view, it would have been AD 32.
That is totally wrong.
Right. We're going to talk about that. Demonstrably wrong. I want to talk about that in a moment. But honestly, if you read their Thursday view, other than that, it's pretty much exactly what we're saying, and it all sounds right. They don't even really bring up hardly any objections that would even make any sense. Like, I don't even think they really point to anything that's a problem. It pretty much solves everything. But then they bring up the Wednesday view down at the bottom. And their strongest proof for a Wednesday is usually talking about the spices and talking about when the women came to purchase spices. So right here in kind of the first part of their paragraph, they say the women purchased spices after the Sabbath, according to Mark 16, verse 1. So I want to go to Mark 16, verse 1, and I want to talk about this for just a second, because I know there's other people that talked to me about this, and they said that that was kind of a hang-up for a Thursday or a Friday view. And here's another thing to note, though, is when they bring up Mark 16, verse 1 in the specific article, they bring up the ESV, which the ESV says, when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. So when you read the ESV, I'll grant you that it really does sound like the way it's worded. I mean, I don't even know if you can have any alternative view here, that they bought spices after the Sabbath. Well, that could potentially present a problem for a Thursday view. I think it's actually solvable, but it would be a problem if you have that view and then you try and reconcile with other passages. So in Mark 16, 1 in the King James, though, we pulled this up. It says, and when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, had bought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him. Now, again, it's a little bit kind of an awkward sentence to me. But again, it says had bought, meaning it was a past tense. So I believe it's just bringing up the fact that they had done this. It's not saying that it happened after the Sabbath is passed. It's just saying right now the Sabbath is passed and they're bringing with them the spices that they had bought.
Well, and so, here's what's going on. You know, what the ESV were saying, then it would say when the Sabbath is passed, you know, they bought the spices. Well, here's the thing. They could still buy the spices on Saturday evening because the Sabbath is sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, as we would think of it. Right. So that means at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, they could go buy spices. So that's no problem for the Thursday view or the Friday view in that sense. Okay.
Right.
But I believe that the King James is accurate when it says that when the Sabbath was passed, they had bought spices. So after the Sabbath passed, they'd already bought the spices. They're just taking them to the tomb. And the reason that the King James is correct is because the King James is taking into account Luke chapter 23, which I believe you're turning to.
Yeah.
And reconciling those two. And this, there's a similar thing going on in Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, where the King James says, the Lord had said to Abraham, get thee out of thy country and so forth. Whereas the ESV just says the Lord said to Abraham. And what it is that they're making the mistake with the ESV of thinking that verb tenses in Hebrew and Greek work the same way as they work in English. And that just simply isn't the case. Okay. And so the King James translators understand the fact that these verb tenses are not necessarily one-to-one always going to translate into English the same way. And so in Genesis 12:1, they're taking Acts 7, verse 2 into account that says that he got that message when he was back in Mesopotamia. And so that's why they correctly translated as the Lord had said to Abraham. And then same thing, or Abram, I should say. And then once we get into Mark 16, it's the same thing. You know, the King James translators, they know what Luke 23 says. And so they're interpreting it as a past perfect in English. They had bought to reconcile with Luke 23. They're still translating the same underlying Greek because the underlying Greek has room for both interpretations.
Right.
But if you take the ESV interpretation, it ends up being misleading in English. In Greek, it's not misleading. In Greek, it could just go either way, but it becomes misleading the way the ESV translates it into English. The KJV translators are interpreting it in light of Luke 23 and giving the reader the correct impression.
Well, and again, you're right that one solution would just simply to say that they bought spices after 6 p.m. on Saturday night. That totally could fix that verse. But again, I believe that it's correct that it's had bought, and it's not referring to that time period. It's actually referring to Thursday between 3 p.m. and 6 p.m. because of what Luke 23 and 24 says. Because if you read Luke 23 at the very end of the chapter in verse 54, I think we can pull it up. It says, "And that day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew on." So it's saying that the Sabbath is coming quickly. Verse 55, "And the women also which came with him from Galilee followed after and beheld the sepulcher and how his body was laid. And they returned and prepared spices and ointments and rested the Sabbath day according to the commandment." So in Luke 23, they obviously have purchased spices and they've prepared them, which would be important because they're not going to do that on the Sabbath day because they can't do any work, and they're not going to do any work on Saturday, and they want to do it as soon as they possibly can. So they have everything basically ready. And then if you look at chapter 24, verse 1, it says, "Now upon the first day of the week, very early in the morning, they came unto the sepulcher, bringing the spices which they had prepared, and certain others with them." So there again, it's the spices that they had prepared, which was from context of chapter 23, the ones they had purchased on that specific Thursday beforehand. So I don't think that the Got Questions article is bringing up a legitimate criticism of the Thursday view. I think it's actually very clear. I think it's just the ESV's wording. Yeah, sure. Maybe the ESV says it kind of weird and tries to create a contradiction. But even if you didn't believe in, our view, it's just a contradiction. It's just, it's like,
yeah, but the ESV reading still isn't a problem for Thursday because they just buy them on Saturday night. But then you'd have a little bit of a contradiction with Luke 23.
Right.
And then you'd have to just say, well, they bought some spices on, Thursday, and then they bought some more on Saturday night or something. I mean, it's kind of a weak argument, to be honest, like making it all about the spices when there's so much other clear evidence. Like, I feel like emphasizing when they bought the spices is kind of silly because there are 10 different ways around this problem. And so to me, it's kind of a nothing burger.
Well, if you go back to the Got Questions article just for another second, because then you have the question of the 3 days and three nights, and I don't even understand what they're trying to say here, but it says supporters of the Wednesday viewpoint see theirs as the only explanation that does not violate the biblical account of the women and the spices and holds to a literal understanding of Matthew 12:40. The 3 days and three nights of Matthew 12:40 are reckoned as follows: early Thursday, day one, late Thursday, night one, early Friday, day two, late Friday, night two, and early Saturday, day three, and late Saturday, night three, which is kind of weird because I'm thinking, like, that's how I counted, essentially, except for I was counting just late day Thursday. But you have to understand that Jesus Christ would have died at even, and you would have had Wednesday night. They don't even have Wednesday night. Like, even
yeah, but
if you
I
said,
think at this point, the God Questions article is just a little off the rails because the God Questions article also screwed up earlier with the 32 AD thing.
Right.
I think this is just the author got a little confused. So I wouldn't say that that's any kind of a mainstream view. I would say that that's just an anomaly with this article, that this article got a little screwed up there.
How did you try to count the 3 days and three nights from Wednesday? Do you remember?
Yeah, absolutely. What I considered it was Wednesday night, Thursday, Thursday night, Friday, Friday night, Saturday, and then Jesus Christ rises during Saturday night. Toward the beginning of Saturday night is when he comes to life. So I would assume that that's how every Wednesday proponent would see it. And everything that I've looked at from people that were promoting Wednesday, articles, sermons and stuff, that's what they taught. So that's why I'm thinking that we should just kind of just reject that part of the article, because I think that's just the author didn't do a very good job of explaining that part. Because
yeah, I think you're right.
I was a proponent of Wednesday for a long time. I've heard a lot of Wednesday people, and what they're saying just isn't accurate. What they're saying makes no sense.
If that view is true, that would mean that he could have technically risen on the first day of the week from a Jewish calendar perspective.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really fit with the Roman calendar as well.
Exactly. Whereas with Thursday view, he's rising the first day of the week from both a Roman and a Jewish perspective.
Exactly.
Which is why it's a superior, one of the many reasons why it's a superior view.
Now, I want to actually address this thing that we brought up in the article about the year, specifically mm-hmm. about the crucifixion. And what's interesting, again, I'm not an expert on this subject at all. I'm definitely going to lean on Pastor Anderson's view here. But because of how accurate astronomy can be, and they can predict and understand how certain things work, I mean, we're going to have a solar eclipse here in the DFW area in a few days or maybe in the next week or so. It's actually a pretty soon event that's going to happen. Because of how these heavenly bodies move at such a consistent, measurable rate, we can actually go forward in future and we can go backwards in time and kind of understand where the heavenly bodies would be through calculations and computer models and everything like that. And this is where, when you look at history and astronomy, we can actually try to figure out dates corresponding to Christ's birth and his crucifixion. Now, I want to kind of hand it over to you because I know you understand this way better than I do. And we have a couple assets for you. So whatever you want to pull up, just let us know and we'll try to pull it up. But
let me just introduce the subject. First of all, we have to understand that the universe is like a clock. Everything is moving according to very set patterns. It's extremely reliable. You can wind back the clock and figure out exactly where the heavenly bodies were on a day thousands of years ago. And the reason that we know that these models are accurate is that when astronomers do these calculations, they can then go and compare them to ancient documents in astronomy from the Greeks, from the Chinese, from the Arabs, and they find that they match their simulations. And so we have confidence within like 5 or 10 minutes about when things happened in the sky, you know, even as far back as 2000 years ago. Already in the 17th century, scientists and astronomers were already trying to use this information to figure out, you know, what was the Star of Bethlehem, or, you know, when was the Passover? What day of the week was the Passover in these various years? Trying to pinpoint the birth of Christ, the crucifixion of Christ. And obviously now in 2024, we have even more advanced calculations, computer models, simulations, and so forth. So you can really get extremely accurate with this stuff now. So the first thing I want to just briefly talk about is when Christ was born. Okay. And what we go by with that is the death of Herod in 4 BC is an important thing to do with that. And so the vast majority of scholars agree that Christ was born in 6 BC. Okay. Now, you know, we want him to be born in 1 AD because that's the whole point of the AD system. But it's just that when that system first originated, it wasn't accurate. It's off by about 6 years. And so actually 6 BC would be the year that Christ was born. If you take all of the data that's given to us in scripture about historical events that were happening at that time, and then we look at historical records of things like the death of Herod. I mean, that's just one of the things. There are lots of other things. I don't want to spend too much time talking about the birth of Christ because we want to focus more on when he was crucified, but I'm just going to throw it out there that he was born in 6 BC. Now, I personally subscribe to the view of this book right here, The Star of Bethlehem by Dr. Michael Molnar. He actually, using the astronomical data and astrological data, he actually pinpoints it down to April 17th, you know, 6 BC. And I believe that he is correct. But even if you don't necessarily buy into his particular theories, he's got this wonderful chart on page 63 where he shows all the different historical events that have to be reconciled, you know, when Herod died and, you know, Jesus being about 30 years old in the 15th year of Tiberius's reign and Archelaus when he ruled, all these different things, they all kind of connect at 6 BC. So that's what we're going to use as a date for the birth of Christ. Okay. So then the question becomes, what year was Christ crucified? Because if we're going to say that it was on a Thursday, then we need to be able to point to a year when the Passover was on a Thursday. Okay. So if you could go ahead and pull up that chart that I sent over to you, Brother Shelley, about the...
Yeah, we have the dates.
Different dates. Yeah.
Let's see if we can pull up the multi-view there and get that asset, or just bring up
the asset. Before you pull that up, I'm going to pull up something different here, which is this article. Well, I'm not going to pull it up. I'll just tell you about it.
Just go ahead and go to the view. You can just switch to the view.
There we go. Okay, yeah, perfect. So here's the thing I want to say going into this is that when I first started researching this, trying to figure out what day of the week the Passover was on in these various years, the numbers are just all over the place. So, I mean, if you look up 10 different articles on this, you're going to get 10 different answers. And so it's really frustrating that there was just so much spurious information out there. And I think that this is kind of an important point to make about looking things up in general, because in 2024, being able to find reliable, accurate information is a skill that everyone needs to have, because there's so much junk and disinfo out there. And so the chart that we're looking at here is actually from a reliable scholarly source. It's from this guy, Dr. Colin Humphreys, from the University of Oxford. So it's a nice, reliable, scholarly source. But not only that, we're also going to verify this ourselves using astronomy software. And hopefully I'm going to be able to share my screen and even show you guys my own look at that data in the astronomy software. Because number one, we want to get reliable sources for our information. But then number two, whenever we can, we want to fact check that stuff ourselves. And I think the reason why there's so much bogus and spurious information out there on this subject is because of the fact that people are getting the data and they're not understanding how to interpret it. So there were a lot of articles online that were even citing reliable sources like the U.S. Navy, astronomical, whatever, observatory, and they had a good source. But then by the time that source information made it to their article, they had screwed up the data, because they were confused between the conjunction and the new moon. They were confused between the 14th day of Nisan and the 15th day of Nisan. This stuff can be a little complicated for somebody who doesn't know a lot about astronomy. And so just warning folks, if you Google this, you're going to get answers all over the place. I'm going to actually give you reliable information right now by going to a scholarly source, and then I'm actually going to prove it to you. Hopefully you'll be able to see it with your own eyes, depending on how clear the screen share is. Okay. So looking at this chart, let me just explain this a little bit. The chart's a little fuzzy on my end, but hopefully you at home can read this thing. But anyway, it says, in fact, I'm going to pull up the chart on my end so I can read it a little more clearly.
We'll share the link too, so then that way people can.
Yeah, share the link so that people can get a clear. So people can get a clear view of the chart. I'm going to just pull it up. My eyesight's not that great these days, so I'm going to pull it up in a separate window.
We'll bring it up even bigger or zoom in a little bit too.
Oh, there we go. That looks better. Perfect. Okay. So looking at this chart, you know, we want to find a Thursday because that's when we clearly believe biblically Christ died. Okay. And if you look at this chart, the only Thursday option that this chart is putting forth is 27 AD. And I'm going to tell you right now that that is not a good option for the crucifixion of Christ. And here's the big problem with 27 AD is that the Bible tells us in Luke chapter 3 that when John the Baptist began his ministry, that it was the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar. Okay. Now, obviously, the reign of Tiberius Caesar is a historical event that we know a lot about because, you know, Roman emperors are a big deal. So there's a lot of historical record regarding them. And so we know historically that Caesar Augustus died in AD 14. So most of the time you will see the reign of Tiberius as starting in AD 14, because that's when Caesar Augustus died. Okay. And as you can see on the screen, it's the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar. This is when John the Baptist starts preaching. This is when the Bible is going to tell us a little later in the chapter that Jesus Christ is about 30 years old. Okay. And so if you stop and think about it, from 14 AD, the 15th year is going to be something like 28 AD or 29 AD. That's definitely not going to work with the, Thursday in 27 AD. Now, here's an important thing to realize, though, is that in AD 12, that's actually the real year that Tiberius Caesar began to reign. Even before the death of Augustus, Tiberius Caesar reigned as co-princeps with full power, as much power as Caesar Augustus. He was fully reigning starting in AD 12. So then if we add the 15 years to that, now we get 26 AD. But that is still not really going to work with this 27 AD Thursday, because if Jesus isn't getting baptized until 26 AD or even 27 AD, well, then there's no time for his ministry, because Christ's ministry was like 3.5 years, right? So if Christ's ministry is like 3.5 years, then you can't have him, starting his ministry in AD 26 and then dying in AD 27. So I believe that this AD 27 Thursday is not a good candidate. So then you might say to yourself, well, that's the only Thursday on the list. So what are we going to do here?
Right.
Okay. Well, look at the Wednesday. There's a Wednesday in 34 AD. Why is that not going to work? Well, the problem with Wednesday AD 34 is that if Christ was born in 6 BC, which is what all of the biblical and historical data points to, then that would actually mean that when Christ died here, he would be like, something like 38 years old or 39 years old or something. And so that's too old, because then, you'd have to make the case that when it says he was about 30 years old, he was actually like 34 or something. And, 34 isn't really like about 30. So that just seems way too late. There's also some stuff with the Apostle Paul's timeline that would not work with this AD 34. AD 34 is just too late. Okay. So there's no good Wednesday option on this list at all, because AD 34 is a bad option. And that's the only Wednesday on the list. And then the only Thursday on the list is 27 AD. That's also a bad option. I'll tell you what the good option is. It's AD 30. Okay. Now you say, wait a minute, Pastor Anderson, it says Friday. Well, this is where we have to dig a little bit deeper, because notice that next to AD 30, Friday, April 7th, notice that it has two crosses. If we go down to the bottom here and look at those two crosses, on the footnote, it says, in each of these cases, it is not impossible, but highly improbable, that 14 Nisan would have occurred on the preceding day. And so according to this chart, which is coming from, of course, Dr. Humphreys at Oxford University, he's saying it's actually possible that in AD 30, it was actually a Thursday, April 6th. Now, he claims it's highly improbable. It's not improbable at all, and I'm going to prove that to you, that it's not improbable. But he's even acknowledging, yeah, it's possible that in AD 30, it's actually a Thursday. We have to, first of all, put ourselves in Dr. Humphreys' mind here. In his calculation, he's reliable on the astronomy. All of his astronomy stuff is great. But the problem is that theologically, he wants it to be a Friday. So he wants there to be as many Fridays as possible. So he wants, a Friday in AD 30, a Friday in AD 33. They're looking for Fridays. But in his chart, he is saying that it's possible that it was Thursday. Now, what's the discrepancy? Well, if we could pull back up the chart, please. Look at the new moon time. Okay. This is the actual scientific data. The deduced date is based on the scientific data. Well, we're going to do that deduction right now. But if we look at the new moon time, okay, for AD 30, it says that it happened on March 22nd at 7:55 p.m. and that this is a plus or minus accuracy of about 5 minutes. Okay. So March 22nd, 7:55 p.m. Now, according to their logic of calculating it for Friday, they are setting the first day of the month as March 24th. Okay. Or I'm sorry, March 25th. They have the first day of the month as March 25th based on their calculation. Now, I don't want you to glaze over here. I don't want to get too complicated here, but I want to explain some of the astronomy here. Do you have the graphics for the new moon that you can pull up?
We can pull those up here in just a second.
Like, what does it mean when it says, you know, March 22nd at 7:55 p.m. was the new moon? Well, if you look at this chart here, this kind of shows the difference between a new moon and a full moon. Okay. So at the top of the screen, we have the new moon where the moon comes between the sun and the earth. So therefore, the side of the moon that's facing the earth is totally dark, whereas the side that's facing away from the earth is lit up by the sun. Okay. Then if you look at the bottom with the full moon, it's the opposite. The earth is between the sun and moon, so that the side of the moon facing us is fully illuminated during the full moon. Now, if you look at this chart, you'd think that like every single month there'd be a lunar eclipse on the full moon, and that every single month there'd be a solar eclipse on the new moon. The reason that that doesn't happen every single month is because they're not rotating in exactly the same planes. But every once in a while, the planes do align, and that's when you get an eclipse. Because as you can see, during the new moon, the moon comes between the earth and the sun. And so that's when a solar eclipse would take place, but it doesn't usually take place because they're not exactly lined up. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So when we talk about the conjunction time, we're talking about the time that the sun, moon, and earth are in this alignment that we see in the upper part of the graphic. That is the conjunction time. That is what took place if you're standing in Jerusalem at 7:55 p.m. on March 22nd, the moon and the sun are in alignment. Okay. Now here's the thing. If the moon and the sun are in alignment, it's of course impossible to see the moon because you're looking at the sun. How can you see the moon if you're looking at the sun? The sun is so bright, it overpowers the moon to where you can't see it. Okay. So what you would expect to see the moon is on the next night, once it's begun to drift a little bit away from the sun. So the reason it's called the new moon is because you're seeing the moon on a daily basis, right? Then when the conjunction takes place on what scientifically is called the new moon, the moon is invisible. It's impossible to see because it's lined up with the sun, unless there's an eclipse, okay? So the new moon is the day when you can start seeing the moon again after this happens. And it'll just be a tiny little sliver as you start getting into the waxing crescent phase. Okay. So here's the deal. According to the scientific data, the conjunction happened at 7:55 PM on March 22nd. What they're basically saying is, well, on the 23rd, they probably didn't see it. They probably didn't see it till the 24th. And then the 25th then would be the first day of Nisan. And then the 14th day of Nisan is that Friday. But what I'm saying is that if the conjunction took place on the 22nd, that yes, they did see the moon the next day on the 20th. That's the new moon. The day after the conjunction, boom, they see it on the night of the 23rd. And then on the 24th, you have Nisan 1. And if Nisan 1 is on the 24th, well, then that means that the 14th day of the month is a Thursday, April 6th, and that Christ was crucified on April 6th, AD 30. Now, I'm going to go ahead and pull up my astronomy software and show that I'm correct about this. And I'm going to show that the scientific data is correct about the conjunction happening at 7:55 on March 22nd, but I'm going to show that the interpretation of that data, the deduced date for Nisan 14, is wrong because the moon is in fact visible on the 23rd. So here's the software that I'm using, and it's called Starry Night Pro. And I've used a lot of different astronomical software, and this is by far the best one. So if you have, a few hundred bucks burning a hole in your pocket and you're really into astronomy, this is the one that I would recommend. And so right now it's just showing like the daytime in Phoenix because, you know, that's what time it is right now, 11:35 a.m. And you can see up here in the corner, March 29th, 2024, et cetera, Phoenix, Arizona. So I'm going to go ahead and set the location to Jerusalem, and then we're going to wind back this clock all the way to 30 AD. And I've already got that saved in the favorites, so I'm just going to pull it up as a favorite and just go there. Okay, so here we are. We've just time traveled to Jerusalem, AD 30, March 22nd. This is the day of the conjunction, according to Dr. Humphrey's data. And as you can see here in the simulation, I've sped it up to 500 times speed so that we can see things happen. You can see here that the moon and the sun are moving together, okay? Because that's what the very definition of the conjunction is, that these things are happening at the same time. And so as we see the sun set, we're also seeing the moon set. And here's the important point to note. By the time the sun is below the horizon and it's dark enough to where you could see the moon, well, guess what? The moon is also below the horizon. This is why it is impossible to see the new moon on the day of the conjunction itself. Now, in order to declare the new month, remember in the Bible, they blow the trumpet on the new moon and they declare the new moon. They are not on a solar calendar. They're on a lunar calendar. In order to declare the new month, you have to see the new moon. They can't see it on March 22nd. And this is where a lot of the charts and articles online screw this up. They start counting sometimes from the date of the conjunction. That's not the new moon. From the, you know, scientifically, you can call that a new moon. But from a perspective of, you know, people declaring a new month based on seeing a new moon in the sky, it can't be the day of the conjunction. It has to be the next day, okay? So if we go to the next day, we go to the 23rd of March. Now you can see that there's a little bit of space between the moon and the sun. Now you still can't see the moon when the sun's out because the sun is overpowering the moon. But what you're going to see is that when the sun goes down, before the moon is all the way below the horizon, you can see that it's dark enough to see the moon. And so like I'm looking at in the simulation, and maybe you at home may not be able to see it as well because of the lower resolution of being live streamed and getting blurry and stuff. But from where I'm sitting, I'm looking at the simulator and I can clearly see the outline of the moon, which makes sense because at this time right here, can I zoom in?
Yeah,
I can try. Yeah. Let me try. I mean, yeah, I mean, there, I can see it clear
you can,
as
you
day.
Can see, there you go. See, there you can kind of see it now.
I mean, there it is. You can see a circle on the screen. It's probably clearer on my screen. But the point is that at 5:55 p.m., you know, the sun is low enough below the horizon and the moon's high enough at the horizon where you can see it. Even at this point, if we fast forwarded to 5:58 p.m., and we have the sun below the horizon, half the moon's above the horizon. They don't have to see the whole thing, folks. All they have to do is see the moon at all.
So how many minutes is that?
Excuse me?
How many minutes is that approximately that we kind of get this view where it can be seen? Is it like 10 minutes, 5 minutes?
Well, based on the simulator, you know, it starts actually being visible like around, you know, vaguely visible around like, you know, 5:30 approximately.
Okay.
And then like it's totally gone in the simulation like a half hour later. So there's like a nice half hour window where you'd be able to see it. And what you have to keep in mind, people, is that the people who are looking for this thing are experts in astronomy. They already know that the conjunction happened on the previous day.
Right.
They're already aware of that. Well, but not only did they not see it, they also mathematically know exactly where the sun and the moon are going to be. They're doing the geometry. These guys are experts. Astronomy was already pretty advanced even at the time of Christ. And so they knew when eclipses were going to happen. They knew.
Well, yeah, the wise men studied the stars to find Jesus Christ, and they had found the North Star, or the star that basically led them to Christ.
Absolutely.
So obviously the Bible testifies to astronomy being a field of study that's really important even at that specific time. And of course, if your calendar's based on a lunar calendar, they probably already know all the days already. They're just, this is kind of the last double check to all the other systems in place.
They're super into it, and it's kind of a technicality of just like, well, we need to see it in the sky. So they have people that are just literally staring at the sky, wanting to see it, and they know mathematically that it's there. And so that's what they do. Now, just for comparison, let's go to the 24th, okay? If we go to the 24th, then yeah, obviously you can see it by a mile. I mean, it's really clear, super clear in the sky that it's pitch black outside, and the moon is still way above the horizon. So there's no question that it's seen by a mile on the 24th. But the question is, did they see it on the 23rd? If they see it on the 23rd at all, then that means that it's a Thursday Passover for AD 30, and it's a perfect year for Christ to be crucified in AD 30, because then that would mean that Jesus Christ, if he was born, as Michael Molnar says, on, you know, April 17th, 6 BC, then that would make Jesus 34 years old when he dies on the cross in AD 30. This would mean that, you know, his ministry is 3.5 years, going from the 15th year of Tiberius' reign, if we accept that Tiberius Caesar began reigning in 12 AD when he became co-princeps. Then we have a perfect 3.5 year ministry for Jesus. We have Jesus being about 31 years old, 30 to 31, when he's baptized. And remember, the Bible doesn't say he was exactly 30. It says about 30. So 30, 31, 31's about 30. Is 34 about 30? Not really. Okay.
So when we look at this chart of dates, just to kind of bring it back to what we were saying earlier, because you've shared a lot of information. It's probably new to a lot of people. This chart specifically has the year 3080 as Friday. But then if you look at the far right where it says April 7th, it has two big plus signs or two crosshairs there. And those crosshairs are denoted in a comment down below, which even says in the specific chart, like, well, it could have actually been Thursday. It could have been the day before. And what you're trying to show is that from an astronomical software where we kind of go back in time and try to look at how the sun and moon would have coincided, that it's very plausible and very realistic that they had a window to have seen the new moon on the day that would have started the calendar for Nisan that year, and it would have put the 14th day at Thursday. So what you're saying is confirming this chart. It's just that the conclusion of this chart's wrong. They're thinking it was Friday, and they're trying to use that to justify Good Friday. Whereas we're saying, yeah, the science and the data's right, but we think it's actually Thursday. This chart should say Thursday there, or should maybe just say Thursday / Friday to be a little clearer as far as possibilities. And then again, when you study that with all the other dates about Christ's birth, the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius, you study when John the Baptist goes out preaching, we compare that with the age of Jesus Christ being about 30 years old, and just all the other events, Herod's death, and just basically all of the history that we have, pretty much it kind of leads to a 30 AD period of time, and it still fits exactly with a Thursday view. Is that a good summary? Is there?
Yeah.
I'm trying to make sure that people at home are probably thinking like, I don't know what you just said, but I'm trying to kind of explain it.
I hope it was clear, but 30 is the sweet spot. And if you pull up that chart again, okay, because 30 is the sweet spot, make it nice and big, perfect. If you look at it, you know, 29's a Monday. That's not going to work in anybody's view. 28's a Tuesday. Not going to work. Okay. 27, you're getting too early. You're really pushing it at that point. Okay. It's possible, but it's extremely unlikely that 27 is going to work because of Tiberius Caesar's 15th year in that. Okay. So you're already pushing it. And then if you start going later, 31, Tuesday is not going to work. 32, Sunday's not going to work. Now, the Friday people, many of them really like this AD 33 view for the Friday crowd. But in my opinion, it's too late. You know, if you have Christ being born in 6 BC, which virtually everyone agrees upon that, there's a lot of data to back that up. And then Michael Molnar with the Star of Bethlehem, that's just icing on the cake. But historically, if you think about it, if Herod died in 4 BC, you know, he's killing the children from 2 years old and upward. So that would mean that Christ has to be born in 6 BC or earlier. And 6 BC works out well with other things. And so therefore, you know, getting into 33 AD is really pushing the timeline. I feel like 34 is even pushing it even more, which is why, again, I feel like this astronomical data favors Thursday more than Wednesday. Because the only possible Thursday or Wednesday is AD 30. Because in AD 30, even though it says Friday on the chart, remember, the data is right. Nobody's arguing about the scientific data. Right. The new moon happened. If we go to the U.S. Navy observatory data, it's going to have the exact same data within a few minutes. I think they're like 10 minutes different than this. But it's still that evening of the 22nd that the conjunction takes place, okay? And so, again, if the conjunction takes place on the 22nd, you're not seeing it on the 22nd. You're going to see it on the next day. The next day is the new moon. What this chart is saying is like, well, I don't think they would have seen it because the sun is just kind of going down and the moon's only there on the horizon for a few minutes. I don't think they'd seen it. My point of view is that they're staring at the horizon and yes, they did see it. And I'm looking at the software and I can see it plainly for a half hour.
Well, and again,
obviously physically being there is not exactly the same as the simulator, but this simulator is pretty stinking accurate.
Well, and you know, here's the thing, somebody that might be a little skeptical when we're talking about astronomy, but here's the thing, God gave us specifically the sun, moon, and stars for the seasons and the times. And because of their accuracy and consistency, you know, to me, it's a testimony of God, how he could create these heavenly bodies that have such accuracy and such consistency and that we can follow them and it helps us actually calculate things. April 8th, there's going to be a solar eclipse in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And, you know, people are already scheduling for this. Look, this hasn't even happened yet, but they know exactly. And they can even draw, there's like maps where they draw the exact lines of where people are going to be seeing these things, the exact time. So again, we can, with very close certainty, measure these things. Additionally, from a historical perspective, people have written about and marked down and tracked all kinds of different solar and lunar events throughout history. And then what happens is people use these softwares to basically go back in time and they're like, hey, this matches exactly what the historical record says. This matches exactly what other individuals have written about. And so again, it's not a huge leap of faith to understand that since God literally created these heavenly bodies for time, that they are consistent and that we can actually wind back the clock and we can see.
So let me explain this one more time.
Let's go to his screen.
So I'm showing this spreadsheet because, you know, I want to just make sure that everybody at home understands what's going on. Okay. So basically this is what everybody agrees on right here. Conjunction happening on March 22nd, right? That's what all the data points do, no matter what astronomer we talk to, the software confirms it. The conjunction took place on March 22nd, right? Then it's on the evening of the 23rd. On the evening of the 23rd, okay, I'm saying that you saw the new moon. They're saying, no, we don't think they could see it on that day. We think they saw it on the 24th. So if you saw it on the 24th, well, then that means if it's the night of the 24th you saw it, then that means the 25th is the first of Nisan, right? Mm-hmm. And if the 25th is the first, the 26th is the second, boom, 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 we count down. And then that's where they're getting this Nisan 14 being on April 7th, Friday in AD 30. Okay. Right. Whereas what I'm saying is, no, actually, we saw it on the 23rd, which means that, you know, the first is actually the 24th. And then, you know, what that puts it to is actually Thursday, the 6th is actually that. So if you're seeing the new moon on this day, which is the actual new moon date, because if the conjunction right. happened on the 22nd, you're, you know, 23rd is when we should see it. They're just saying, nah, couldn't see it. I disagree, and the simulation disagrees. So I don't know if that helps a little bit. And then maybe we could just, I can just quickly go back to my astronomy window and just show it one more time. Cause I feel like,
so. I think this is something that people, it's so new. We can go back and forth a couple times so people can kind of see and they get a better picture of what we're talking about here.
Yeah. Cause again, it's a new concept. It probably wouldn't hurt to hear it a couple times.
Right.
Okay. So,
and again, boom. We talk about seeing it. But we have to think about the fact that these people were anticipating this. They would have been looking for this and wanting to see this. They would have known that this would have been the correct date to have subscribed to that. And so, you know, it makes sense if they're staring at the horizon while the sun's setting, recognizing it's going to be difficult to see the new moon. They have a 30-minute window to see it. As soon as they see it, they mark it. Yep, we saw it. Check mark. Blow the trumpet. And we're going to start our next calendar for Nisan.
Yeah, mathematically, they want it to be on the 23rd because they know that the conjunction's happening on the 22nd. And so, boom, here we are, AD 30, Jerusalem, Israel, March 22nd. And boom, look, you can see the moon is right there with the sun. Now, they're not exactly lined up because if they were lined up, then you'd have a solar eclipse. You can see how it's off to the side, but it's in line. In the sense that, you know, there's no way that you could see it on that day because by the time the sun is down, the moon's way below the horizon.
Right.
We go to the next day, 23rd, and boom, we have the sun down before the moon, and you can clearly see the circle outline there. And again, it's not going to be as clear for the people at home just because of the constraints of the internet and so forth. But on the, you know, software itself, the way I'm looking at it, it's visible for like a half hour.
Right.
But the key thing to notice is just the location.
Sure.
You know, the sun, look at the sun, folks. Look how far the sun is below the horizon. And boom, the moon is still above the horizon.
Yeah.
So it's not highly improbable at all to think that they saw it. Then if we fast forward to the 24th. Which is the day that they're proposing it would be seen. If we go to the 24th, then yeah, the sun's way down and you're just seeing it by a mile, right? I mean, it's just way up there in the sky,
sure,
pitch black. You can easily see the circle and so forth. So
well, and again,
I
the
hope
conjunction,
that
yeah, you were bringing up the conjunction later. And a conjunction is by definition, something being joined. So what he's talking about is the path of the moon and the sun are joined together to where you're not able to really see the moon at all because of the brilliancy of the sun. And the next day, they're not as close together. They're not as conjoined. They're not as similar paths. There's a little bit of separation, and that separation affords, based on the simulation, about a 30-minute window. I would be content with a 5-minute window because I would assume, again, they're staring at it, waiting for
it. Exactly.
Like they're ready to go. And again, it's just kind of a check mark. Like we already know this day is the right day. We're just kind of waiting and we got to make sure to do our due diligence to see the particular new moon and then we'll blow the trumpet. But it's not something that they're just willy nilly like, oh, we were drinking and we forgot or we were busy or using the bathroom or we
Hey, somebody noticed, somebody looked outside and they noticed it's a new moon. Somebody blow the trumpet.
Someone do something.
They're literally professional astronomers staring at the sky looking for the new moon. And they know that it's supposed to be there on that day and that theoretically it could be seen. And so all they have to do is catch a glimpse of even part of it. if they see it, it's the new moon. Okay.
Right.
And the word conjunction is a term that's just used whenever heavenly bodies are lined up in an interesting way. Like you'll hear people talk about, hey, tonight there's going to be a really interesting conjunction because you go outside and you'll see like the planets lined up or lined up with the moon or something, just some kind of a cool alignment. So when we talk about the conjunction taking place on March 22nd at 7:55 p.m., we're just saying that's when the Earth, Moon, and Sun are aligned. Okay. And here's the thing. In the course of a month, we go through the whole cycle. So, you know, when half the month goes by, instead of it being aligned as like, here's the Earth, here's the Moon, here's the Sun, you know, by the time half the month goes by, now the Moon's on the opposite side. Because, you know, it takes a month, right, for the Moon to go through its cycle. So when the Moon's on the opposite side of the Earth, then you have the full Moon. That's a conjunction as well. The difference is that on the exact day of the full Moon, we can see the full Moon because it's fully illuminated in the sky. It's beautiful. We see it. We can't actually see the new Moon during the conjunction because it's lined up with the Sun and the Sun is overpowering it. Okay. Because on the full Moon, the Moon and Sun are on opposite sides of the Earth. So that's why the full Moon rises at sunset. Okay. Whereas the new Moon rises at dawn and it's actually setting at sunset because it's moving with the Sun.
Right.
And so you can't see it because it's overpowered by the Sun. So the full Moon, you're seeing it on the exact day of the full Moon, exact day of the conjunction. Whereas the new Moon, the soonest you can see it is the day after the conjunction.
Well, every time
what happened in AD 30, they saw it on March 23rd.
Yeah. Every time you use that word conjunction, I'm thinking of conjunction, junction, what's your function from Schoolhouse Rock. So I thought it was good that we would bring up the right definition of what we're talking about here. But, you know, I think that that's pretty clear, especially, you know, going through it many times, kind of showing that. And again, this is just another nail in the coffin of a Wednesday view in a sense, just because of the fact that there really isn't a strong option for Wednesday. You could argue for Friday, and again, that's what they did, but you can tell that they're kind of stretching the data to get to Friday. They're not necessarily even going with what should be the correct day. They're saying like, well, it was kind of a hard event to see that day, so we theorize that it's most likely a Friday when it really just kind of fits Thursday. And to me, it's that Catholic doctrine poisoning the mind of people that did really good calculations, and they did all the right calculations, but then they just had to squeeze out Friday and try to figure it out.
Just to be clear though, that, you know, the guy who did this chart and who did these calculations, Dr. Humphreys, you know, he's pushing for specifically AD 33. Oh. He actually prefers AD 33, but you know, a lot of other people really like that AD 30 date because AD 30 works way better than AD 33. Just with all things being considered, AD 30 is the best date, especially if you realize that Tiberius Caesar is co-princeps starting in AD 12. Then everything falls into place. I don't like the AD 33 year at all because of the fact that it just makes Jesus way too old.
Right.
You know, and it's just, he's not about 30. If he's 33, 34 years old, that's kind of a stretch. Whereas according to our view, he's like 30 or 31 years old. 31 years old is perfect for being about 30. And so, you know, the AD 33 though is popular with the Friday crowd. And if it was AD 33, it has to be a Friday. So it's off the table for those of us who believe in Matthew 12, 40, you know, 3 days and three nights. Whereas AD 30 is favored by a lot of Friday people as well. But again, they're wrong because it's, as we looked at the astronomy, it's actually AD 30. It was on a Thursday that year. I was just going to say, if people try to Google this to fact check me, let me just warn you, you're going to find dates all over the place. You're going to find every possible date for every possible Passover for every possible year, because people don't understand the astronomy and they don't know what they're talking about. And that's why the data is just all over the place. If you actually go to reliable scholarly sources, you will find that the day of the conjunction is consistent in the scholarly data. It's also consistent with the simulator, and it's just a matter of interpreting that data. So don't just try to Google some random article to fact check me on this. Like, you go to the actual scholarly sources, the actual data, and know how to interpret it, you're going to come to the same conclusion I've come to. Now, if you want to make the argument that they didn't see it during that 30-minute window because it was still too bright from the sun glowing a little bit there, you know, well, okay, that's your prerogative. But, you know, based on the simulator and based on my opinion and my own personal observations of just looking at new moons over the years, because we've all seen it. I mean, we've all gone outside and seen new moons at sundown. While the sun is still glowing a little bit, there's still a bit of glow in the sky, and we see that new moon.
Right.
I know I've seen it.
And, you know, when we talk about the Tiberius issue, I wanted to bring this up because someone might try to fact check that and say, oh, well, he started reigning in 14 AD, but you brought up that he's co-princeps or however you want to say that, but he's basically co-reigning with Caesar Augustus. And here's the reality. The reason why he's co-reigning is because Augustus is sick and ill and can't reign. And so if you look at just even the Wikipedia article about it, they make it clear that, yeah, prior to this, in around 12 AD, back after a military campaign, Tiberius basically receives co-joining ruling status, and he's basically the default ruler for the time period that Augustus is sick and ill. So it wouldn't make any sense that if he rules for 2 years while this other guy's sick, ill, and not able to do much, and then he finally dies, it's like, oh, now your reign starts. This is the first year. You'd be like, no, this is my third year reigning, which is why we get the 15 years plus 12 is 27 AD. And again, that gives approximately three and a half, almost four years. It doesn't even have to be
27 AD. It could even be 26 AD if you count inclusively.
Right.
If you count 12 as the first year, right?
Sure.
If you count inclusively, it could be 26 AD, which gives a good, nice, solid, and I would say that it's 26 AD when John the Baptist started his ministry, because then maybe, let's say, Jesus doesn't get baptized immediately when John starts his ministry. Maybe he gets baptized months later, you know, several months later. So it's a perfect, like, 3.5 year ministry for Jesus. And Jesus dies at age 34. So Jesus dies at 34 years of age, because if his birthday is April 17th, and if he's crucified on April 6th, then he's about to turn 35, but he's only 34. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, I agree with your counting there, because it's similar to how you count the feast called the Passover, because while it's 14th day to this 21st day, that sounds like simple math at 7, but it's actually 8 days. So like you said, if we're starting in 12 AD, if you count up 15, it would actually be AD 26, giving us approximately maybe a year for John the Baptist and then 3.5 years for Jesus Christ. So, you know, that definitely.
Yeah, I think most people would say, you know, it's either like 3 or 6 months that people usually say for like how long John the Baptist ministry is going before Christ jumps in.
Takes over. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
So gets again, baptized.
I think that that's really interesting. That's something that that was not a part of my decision making. I totally had converted and changed my mind on the specific chart and the timing before all this. But I know that during my process of trying to talk with you and kind of convince you, this was something that you were bringing up, and it was something that you were studying at the time. And so I researched it as well. And I will totally confirm that I could find dozens of articles that say all kinds of crazy dates about all these different things. But there are plenty that do agree with what you're saying. There's plenty of articles that do say specifically 30 AD, or bring up that being a timeline for Thursday. So it's not like this is a minority view or anything like that. It's actually probably, at least within reputable sources, the prevailing view. It's just that there's a lot of trash on the internet because people want to fit all kinds of weird Jewish conspiracies or their crazy doctrines.
Yeah. And again, I want to emphasize to the viewer at home the importance of knowing how to do research and knowing what is a reliable source, what is not. And also, you know, if someone's citing a reliable source, You need to actually look that up, because a lot of times people will cite a reliable source and what they're saying is not what that source says. They've twisted the data. They've corrupted it. They're quoting it wrong, whatever. You've got to learn to discern what is reliable, what is not, and then go to the actual fountainhead, go to the actual sources yourself. And if you can, fact check these things yourself. Also, even when you're looking at a reliable source, you have to be able to differentiate between that which is solid data and that which is the conclusion being drawn from the data. You know, and when it comes to like one of, you know, we talked about Creation a few weeks back, and, you know, I personally, I enjoyed the film, Is Genesis History?
Yeah.
That documentary film. And it, you know, was a lot of like scientists that believed in the Bible and believed in creation and stuff like that. And what they brought up a few times was that a lot of times we're looking at the same data. It's just, we're interpreting the data differently.
Right.
You know? And so you have to be able to differentiate between what is the data. That's the conjunction time, 7:55 PM, March 22nd, versus the deduced date of 14 Nisan. You know, that's a few steps removed of somebody giving their opinion and whatever. And so we can all agree on the astronomical data. The astronomical data is incredibly accurate, like within 5 minutes or something, 10 minutes or something.
Yeah.
And so there's no question about the conjunction happening on March 22nd. It's just a matter of interpretation of, did they see it on the 23rd? You know, we can't really know 100% for sure either way. And so that's like, is it Thursday? Is it Friday? But if the Bible teaches it's Thursday, though, then it must have been Thursday.
Well, and again, we, you know, in your creation discussion that we had with Dr. Hovind, you kind of kept drawing on the board like all these data points and then like a line going through them. And you're talking about extrapolating the data outside of the data points. But when we talk about these astronomy things, we actually have tons of data points in the future and in the past that we use to correlate, and it's always matching exactly. So we actually have a lot of calibration. So this is much different than something like radiometric dating or carbon dating, where many times when they have known samples or even very close to known sample ages and they come up with wild dates, well, that doesn't present itself as a very exact science. Whereas, like you said, with this astronomy calculation, they're pretty much always getting things within a pretty small window of error, 5-10 minutes or something like that, to where we can really actually wind back the clock and push it forward with a certain degree of certainty, with a lot of accuracy. And even the events that we're going to see in the future, we're pretty much nailing them. I mean, we got it exactly. We're going to have a solar eclipse here. We know about it. This isn't like some pseudoscience or something, or you have to believe some conspiracy of the government, like the government's doing something to manipulate the sky. It's like, nope, this is just literally a solar eclipse. It's going to happen. And there's lunar eclipse. There's all kinds of different things, the blood moons and stuff.
Well, there's a cool story. And this is going back like 500 years. There's a cool story where Christopher Columbus, he was trying to kind of get the Indians to submit and do what he wanted. So he told them like, hey, God's mad at you guys. And like, he's going to darken the sun on this day and whatever. And it was really just because he had some almanac telling him when the eclipses were going to happen. And this is, think about, Columbus sailed in 1492. It's a long time ago. Think about how much more advanced astronomy has become in the last 500 years with computers and just so much more advanced.
Well, we're probably standing on the shoulder of those people.
Exactly. And he predicted this eclipse, and then the Indians were super freaked out, like, oh man, like, how did he know? And so
it's a god.
Kind of a cool story from history. But like you said, we're not extrapolating. Now, if we tried to say, well, this is what the sky looked like in, you know, 4000 BC or something, obviously we don't have any records that go back that far.
Sure.
And so, you know, then at that point, you know, you could still assume that things are going the same way. Why would they change? But as far as like actual hard data, we do have hard data from the time of Christ, because you have astronomers before Christ. You have Greek astronomers before Christ. You have some wonderful records from the first few centuries AD. You've got then you've got Chinese records, you've got Arab records, you got Greek records, you even have Babylonian records from before Christ and everything.
Right.
You know, varying levels of specificity and stuff.
Sure.
But if they're drawing and describing what they're seeing in the sky, and then we go to the simulator, roll it back, and boom. Oh, they said there was an eclipse. Boom. The software shows an eclipse that same day. Oh, they're looking at these stars. We're seeing the same thing in the simulation. That's how we know it's accurate. You check the simulator with historical records. Just like the same thing with carbon dating. You know, they can calibrate carbon dating back to about 1000 BC because they have certain things that they found from that time period. And then they know historically, they know, you know, pretty much, okay, this is when this pharaoh reigned or whatever. And then you can actually calibrate the thing. So,
right. And again,
if you go back and say, well, you know, we're carbonating this to 8000 BC, you know, that's again, you know, you're getting outside of the actual known data at that point.
Yeah. And we have a lot of these data points that are from different sources and different areas, you know, it starts to bring the accuracy level in to a certain level of certainty. The only astronomical event that I can see in the Bible that kind of it seems like maybe it's just a miracle is when the sun stands still for like a whole day.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't
That's
know.
That's for sure a miracle, yeah.
I don't know that you could really explain that from the natural occurrences. I don't think that's possible at all. So that's most
you can't
likely
because it's
some
it's
kind
explicitly,
of a miracle.
It's explicitly a miracle. You know,
so,
and so
we could be a day off, right? I mean, but again, like generally speaking, these things.
Yeah, but
are
that
consistent.
doesn't affect this.
No, it doesn't affect this. That's that before.
That's like 1500 years before Christ or something.
Right.
And so
exactly.
That's not even, that doesn't even mean anything with this. And, you know, the astronomy records are all after that anyway.
Well, I think a lot of times people have a weird view because they've been taught so much evolution that they don't realize how much it's kind of affected their perspective. They think that generations before us are a bunch of ooga booga, like they don't really know anything. And because of computers and stuff, like now we're smart or something, but there's always been very smart people that have studied a lot of these things in time past. A lot of technology and information that we use today was built on the backs of generations in the past and their knowledge and their understanding. So it's kind of it's a misnomer, I think, from a lot of people's perspective. They think that past generations or a long time ago, everybody's just dumb or everybody was inferior to the intellect of people today, whereas that's not a true reflection of history. Of course, there were time periods when reading was really low, literacy was really low, and I'm sure that the common people, you know, a lot of them were not very educated. But again, colleges and education has been a common theme throughout history. Smart people have studied a lot of these things in times past, and we're really standing on the shoulders of those data engineers, and we're just putting the data in a computer. But it's not like we're just discovering all this new stuff. You know, people already understood how astronomy works. They understood mathematics. They understood a lot of these things, and we're just – and many times catching up or figuring out how to use computers to solve those problems. But the problem with computers, I think, is it's actually caused a lot of people to be dumber because we rely on that tool and that instrument rather than having the head knowledge. Whereas in times past, many of these individuals knew how to calculate these things on paper and pen and could understand and talk about them intelligently, whereas today people would have to rely on tools and software. So,
well, and here's another really interesting thing that a lot of people might have heard of, the Antikythera mechanism. Are you familiar with that at all, Pastor Shelley, or no?
No.
So this is something that was found like in the Mediterranean Sea, like, but they found it underwater. It was this artifact of a machine from like the second century BC. So like over 2000 years ago. It's this mechanism with like all these turning gears and stuff. And it's basically an astronomy device for predicting eclipses. So it's like this primitive machine where it's all these moving parts, just tons of gears and everything. And basically like you put in the date and then it kind of tells you what's going on from an astronomy perspective during that date, and you can use it to predict eclipses, and it tells you what month, what year, and what. So it kind of was a mind-blowing discovery of just, wow, these people, not only were they advanced in their knowledge, but they actually built this little machine. And I use the word machine, but it's really just a lot of gears turning. Obviously it's not electronics. Some people describe it as describe as like a computer or something, but obviously it's not electronic at all. It's just, it's something that's hand cranked. You turn you turn the dials, and it tells you when the eclipse is going to happen.
An abacus or something. It's just like a physical device calculates things.
But it's really advanced though.
Sure.
And so it's really cool. It's like you said, you know, they weren't going ooga booga 5,000 years ago, because let's face it. I mean, you see people just building mega cities, building the pyramids. I mean, they're building some pretty incredible stuff because they're
aqueducts, plumbing is mentioned in the Bible. Like a lot of these things that we kind of think that don't exist really are mentioned in the scripture. And they weren't
even the Indus River Valley civilization had like plumbing and stuff.
Sure. And again, like Solomon's considered the smartest man to ever live. So, you know, that he's like a peak of intellect and wisdom at that time. I mean, they're building buildings without hammers. Like they're building the temple of the Lord without hammering. Yeah. And it's like one of the most magnificent structures of all time. Like, you know, I would almost argue in some ways society is kind of losing intelligence or losing wisdom. Obviously, in some ways we're increasing in knowledge and technology. So I think like it's just kind of, it's like a complex, you know, understanding. In some ways,
I wouldn't say that we're getting dumber. This is what I would say. I would just say we were super smart then and we're super smart now, because humans are just smart. And so obviously the general public is dumb, but the general public was dumb 2,000 years ago. The general public was dumb 4,000 years ago. But like there have always been people who are smart and they're engineering things and they're doing astronomy, they're doing science. Like there's always been people who are into learning and into intellect, and people who just kind of don't care. And they're just kind of just whatever, just, you know, give me another ice cream cone, turn on the cartoons, let's go. You know, like there've always been people who cared about learning and people who didn't care about learning.
Right.
And I think that, I don't think that the scientists of today or the mathematicians of today are inferior to the ones from 2,000 years ago. I would just say they're smart now, they're smart then. It's the same humans. Human nature is the same. There's no new thing under the sun. Like, well, you brought up Solomon, and I mean, he's talking about plants, he's talking about animals. Sure. He's doing biology,
right?
You know, like before Aristotle.
Well, I'm just saying, like, to me, the viewpoint that I have is it's kind of like smart people have always been smart. Like every civilization, every generation has really smart people, and they're always at a high level. Mm-hmm. But the general populace kind of goes through a roller coaster of the general pop is kind of increasing knowledge and then going down and going up, and it kind of ebbs and flows. And like, it seems like our current generation is, you know, kind of in a decline. Like seems like, you know, when they look at SAT scores and just the fact that we have to rely on so much technology, it almost seems like the general populace has having a little bit of a dumbing down effect, lower literacy, lower, just research and studying material. So like the general populace is kind of waning. But of course, the smart people today, people like Elon Musk and other individuals, are still highly intelligent, creating all kinds of advanced technology. New stuff is being discovered on a regular basis. So like, I would agree, like smart people have just always been smart, and we've always had them. And they're the ones kind of building society, building civilization, keeping everything kind of running. But the general populace kind of ebbs and flows from, you know, certain degrees of
I'm not necessarily quite as pessimistic about like
the current generation.
But I mean, because in some ways, like obviously, we're disappointed sometimes with people's level of knowledge, but I just think it's always been that way, to be honest.
Yeah, that's probably true.
You know, I mean, and honestly, as far as just globally, literacy is at an all-time high globally. You know,
I would agree with that. I think that, and again, you could almost argue we have a higher level of intelligence globally than maybe times past, just because of literacy specifically.
Yeah,
I'm just saying, like, I guess I'm hyper focused on America and just maybe yeah, the most recent decades.
I think you're hyper-focused on like college campuses too. And I think that part of the reason because of that, because I know you've gone to some college campuses and you found some people that weren't that smart. But the point is like, I think that the difference there is that if you go back to like our parents' generation, is that only a small minority went to college.
Oh, that's true.
And so the people that were going to college were kind of like elite. The elite, they're intellectual, they're smart. Whereas now people have this attitude of like everyone should go to college. So then what happens is you have a lot of people going to college who are not intellectual. They're not excelling at their studies. They're not that into it. They don't really care, but they're just kind of being funneled into like 13th grade. Like, okay, sure. Here we go. So I think that there are just as many smart people on college campuses now as there used to be, but you've also just brought in a lot more of the general population that are kind of just, you know, not at a high level that are studying in college. And
there are
going to be easy classes to accommodate those kind of people.
Yeah, the degree plans have broadened. So, you know, for the most part, people are going to college to become a doctor or a lawyer or some really highly skilled technical position or to study something in an advanced setting. Whereas now they just have such a broad array of degrees and fields of study. And yeah, there's definitely, because of the increase of just the quantity of people going to college, that could maybe seem like academically it's not as superior. But I agree with you that there's still the super smart people are there. And, you know, in times past, it's a little bit different. So maybe it's not fair to compare. But I think that, you know, there have been some articles and some research to suggest that just even in high schools, comparing just high schools, that maybe SAT scores or ACT scores or some of that stuff has kind of gone downhill a little bit, or maybe there's been a little bit of a decrease in literacy rates. That could also be explained by some other factors as far as just increased migration and diversity and things like that too. So, you know, I don't
like you said, it's probably like a cycle a little bit, like ebbs and flows. You know, certain generations are maybe a little more into education than others or learning.
But, you know, and obviously this podcast was not catering to the weak of mind. We were trying to talk about some advanced topics. I really appreciate you coming on the stream with me. I don't know why, but this is fun for me. I know for some people it might be kind of boring or not really their jive, but you know, this is something I get excited about. I liked making the chart. I like sharing and talking about it. I've already preached several sermons on it, so I kind of like doing the stream and having the visual aids, because I feel like the visual aids make kind of a big difference for me and for other people probably as well. I really find the astronomy stuff super interesting. I'm glad you got to share the software, and I appreciate you coming on here. Of course, you know, obviously the most important thing is just believing the death, burial, and resurrection and putting your faith in Christ for salvation. So salvation is, according to the Bible, a free gift. It's just by faith alone. That's not, you know, Good Friday is not the only thing Catholics get wrong. They think it's by works that you have to be saved, and they're wrong on that as well. Salvation's clearly a free gift just by faith. It's all what he did. And I love that picture of Christ being in the tomb and it being Sabbath for man, showing Christ doing the work for us and then rising again from the dead. And simply salvation is trusting in his rest. The Bible describes salvation as a Sabbath, that we're entering into his rest, and that Jesus Christ truly paid it all. He did everything for us necessary for our salvation. And I just hope that people will appreciate the Bible more. And the goal of a stream like this, to me, is to show that we can trust the Bible. The Bible's right. The Bible's accurate. There's no contradiction. And that we should trust every word and not get a Catholic view of just like, oh, well, you know, it's just mistranslated, or you got to change it here. Well, you know, it's not a big deal. You know, that's their take on Christianity. And, you know, we want to get every word of God. We want to get it dialed in. We want to believe the scripture. And of course, there's plenty of people that believe the Bible and are faithful Christians, and they believe in the Wednesday view. And I'm not down on you. I've definitely held that view. But I think that, you know, it makes sense to reconcile all the verses, make sure that they all match. And I think Thursday does that perfectly. Do you have any final thoughts for us before we kind of wrap up this afternoon?
No, I think that was a great wrap up that you just gave. I mean, one thing I do just think is kind of cool about the 30 AD is just that it's like exactly 40 years before the destruction of the temple. So that's kind of a nice clean number, you know, with the 40 years going by and then the temple being destroyed. But again, I agree with you. If people believe in Wednesday or Thursday, those, you know, are both, you know, good positions to have. Although, you know, Thursday is the one that I strongly believe is correct. And even if people are mixed up and believe Friday, I mean, you know, they're still saved. They're just, you know, they're just not maybe understanding those scriptures. And so,
right.
I enjoyed being on here. I like these topics, and I just want to thank you for even basically educating me on this subject, because of the fact that, you know, you're kind of the first person that did a deep dive and was able to really, you know, give a comprehensive view to convince me of Thursday. So,
well, and it's crazy because I didn't try. I did try to prove Wednesday and I gave up. And then just one day reading Mark, I believe it's Mark 14. It just totally changed my mind. I said, I think I can figure this out. And, you know, I just kind of took the time to try and really study what the Bible is saying on that issue. And it seemed like a puzzle that was just slowly getting put together. And you know, when you get to that final stage, it's kind of fun. Like, puzzles are frustrating because it just takes forever to get the edges. But it's like, once you get the edges and you get the big piece, then there's like this kind of fun rush at the very end where you're just kind of putting every one of those last little puzzle pieces in there. And then it just all fits together. And it's just like, it's a lot of fun. If you've ever done a puzzle, like kind of the last few minutes, you're just putting pieces in like left and right, just going super fast. And it's a lot of fun. That's kind of how I felt with this. It was like, it took a while to get all the edges in, but then it was like, bam, just everything just started clicking. It made a lot of sense. Last Supper started making a lot of sense. The crucifixion made a lot of sense. All the Sabbath days made a lot of sense. And I didn't have it prepared with me, but I'm just going to shoot from the hip on this. But I did do a little research on like what quantity of the Gospels specifically are talking about the Passion Week. Like, they're focused on just this last 1 week or the Holy Week of Scripture. And it's about 33% of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are dedicated, as far as just the chapters, if you just look at like the chapters or the amount of text dedicated just to that last week, it's almost a third of the New Testament specifically. So I think that getting the right timeline and kind of looking at this chart and getting it in your heart actually really helps you understand a large section of the New Testament, because a lot of the New Testament, a lot of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are focused on specifically this time period. I mean, you have John 12 all the way to virtually chapter 20 is focused just on the specific week. And you have many large portions of Matthew, Mark, and Luke also dedicated to just this specific 1 week of time. And of course, it's a really important week of human history, is the Passover, is Jesus Christ being our Passover. That's why we even celebrate the Lord's Supper, is specifically to celebrate what Jesus Christ did for us. And so I really appreciate you guys tuning in. If you want to check out Pastor Stephen Anderson, you got to check out Faith Word Baptist Church. Give us some of the plugs. Where do we find your preaching?
I mean, the best place to go is just thepreaching.com. Or if you just Google Faith Word Baptist Church, you know, there's all kinds of talk about how bad we are. But, you know, it should also link to our website at some point.
Yeah.
But I just usually, it's faithforwardbaptist.org is the website, faithforwardbaptist.org. But an easy way to get there is just to type in thepreaching.com.
Great. And, you know, you can check him out on Rumble. He's got a couple channels there. I'm going to try and put in the description of this video after we're done a lot of the links to some of the stuff that we're sharing. On our website specifically, sbckjv.com, you can find the timing of the Passover chart that I have. One sad thing is you can't share that on Facebook. I guess Facebook's blocked all of our URLs and everything like that. But you could like download the chart and re-upload it just a picture or something apart from our website link address. But you can't ever link to me or my name or anything with our church on Facebook. So, you know, some people like to try and share this information. If you run into that issue, there's other ways to share it. But also follow us on Rumble, our Steadfast Baptist Church channel. We also have an email list. We started a new one, baptistbias.com rumble.com/join. You can join us, and we're, you know, we love Rumble. Rumble's great, but we never know how long Rumble's going to keep us. And so you can do that. I also added a locals button on our channel, and I'm not planning on putting any paid content out there at this time. I don't think I ever will, but it's just an opportunity. If people want to help us or support us, you can do so. There's a community feature there where you can go through. And I really appreciate you joining us. It was a long stream. If you just caught part of it, make sure to go back to the beginning. We laid down a lot of foundation, a lot of important information there. We want you to follow the whole video. And, of course, make sure you go to church this Easter. We want to celebrate the resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. That's going to do it for us. Everyone's got a perspective, but you need to get the Baptist bias.